This is side one, track one.
Maybe just give you a name. Maybe just tell me a little bit about what you did before you went into the army.
Well, my name's Harold Atkinson. They call me Harry now, but it's Harold Atkinson. Well, before the war, how can I put it? I quit school in grade 9, I guess, and went to work back then. I was a buy boy then, a messenger boy between the retail and the wholesale. And I joined the non-permanent militia in 1939. And in 1940, in August, I joined the army. I wasn't old enough in
1939. Well, had the war broken out when you joined the army?
Oh, yes, yeah. The war had started then. And
did you know anybody in the Grenadier? I just wonder why.
Well, no, I wasn't in the Grenadiers right at the start, Ross. I went, with my age being what it was, Sergeant Major Kearns tore my documents up and told me to go home because I was only 18. And I went down 2 weeks later and re-enlisted again and went through it all again and told them my age was 20. I've had all my records changed since, but I was actually 18. And I went out to Brandon on a staff in a training center. At that time, they started 30-day training for the younger men. And it was to convince them that they should enlist, to show them what army life was like more than anything else. And they prettied it up somewhat. But anyway, I was there until February, March of 1941, when in the interim, my brother and a group of them from the training center staff had come to Winnipeg to the university to take an artillery course. They were changing the center over to an artillery training center, and I had...
This was in Winnipeg?
In Winnipeg here, yeah, they came in from Brandon. And subsequent to that, I'd gone to Lethbridge, Alberta on an anti-gas and BT course. And when I come back, they had transferred to the Grenadiers. There was a reinforcement draft going to Jamaica. And he phoned me on a Saturday night and suggested that if I wanted to get away overseas with them, I should get into Winnipeg. And one way or the other, there was, other than the staff in the camp in Brandon, that's all there was. And on the Sunday morning, I buttonholed a regimental sergeant major out there and the colonel and wangled a transfer to Winnipeg. That's the way it ended up. But I didn't go to Sherbrooke with them. Sherbrooke, Quebec, then went down there for 6 weeks training. I stayed in Winnipeg. And when they came back from there, we re-embarked again and went to Jamaica.
Did you remember about how much training you had received at
the time?
What kind of training did you
have? Personally, by then, as I say, I'd gone on a gas course. I was a qualified B in my qualifications, qualified B gas instructor, anti-gas instructor.
What does that mean?
In the Second World War, there was a chance of me using poisonous gas and gas of any description, the same as they did in the First World War. And it was our job to train personnel in anti-gas methods. Proper use of a respirator, identification of different gases. And I guess if gas had been used, anybody that hadn't had training that way, it would have been their job to decontaminate an area. We hadn't had some of that training, but this would have gone on and on. Luckily enough, gas wasn't used, and we never had to use that.
You mentioned PT.
Physical training.
Oh, physical training. Mm-hmm.
And we also had a physical training course. I've often wondered since what would have happened if I hadn't transferred to the Grenadiers and stayed in Brandon as a PTI and gas inspector. Chances are I'd have ended up in Europe, and I might not have come home. That's the way I look at it. Anyway, we had a lot of fun on those courses. Lethbridge is quite a town.
Oh, I forgot.
But we ended up, we left, I can't give you the exact dates that we left for Jamaica, but I know it was near the end of May that we arrived down there. There was a group of 70 men, and I think about 10 officers. Lieutenant White, I think, and Dennis were in charge of the party. And there was Lieutenant McKechnie, you may have already interviewed him, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, Prendergast, Lieutenant Prendergast, Lieutenant Parks, Pooky Parks, as we call him now. I could if I went back in my, some of my correspondence I had in there. And we were down there until September. And come back here to Winnipeg. And we were attached to D Company somewhere. But you were asking about training.
Yeah, I was asking.
All right, we had to get back to it. I got away from it. We had the anti-gas and PT, as I say. I was, personally, I was trained in the use of musket, Lee Enfield 303. In the use of what we had then was a Lewis gun. It was an air-cooled gun with a barrel and a drum magazine and a butt that you held to your shoulder.
Semi-automatic?
Automatic.
Automatic?
Yeah, automatic and semi-automatic. It could also be fired from a bipod, but it wasn't. It was too heavy a gun to hold up to your shoulder without a stand underneath. It had a thin barrel. This is where the air cooled part of it came from. The Bren gun we had never seen, and we didn't see until we got on board ship going to Hong Kong, nor had we seen a Thompson submachine gun. But in that period of time, from May until when we went down in May, Corporal Kelso from D Company, Corporal John Kelso, and a number of other NCOs, I can't give you their names, had come back to Canada on the ship back and went to Borden or to train in that area in Bren gun and mortar, Thompson submachine gun. And they were our instructors on the ship. Went over. This is the first time we've seen the Bren gun. We had some firing of Bren on ship. Mortar, no. We went through the phases of firing a mortar, but we had no mortar bombs. This would be both the 3 and 2 inch mortar. None of us had ever fired a mortar, actually, until we get into action. We didn't have any ammunition to look at in
action. What did you make? Did you generally go in and shoot?
Well, ourselves, myself personally, no. Now, the Grenadiers, I have this to say, the Grenadiers were well trained in the Vickers. They were a Vickers machine gun battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Myself and those that went down on that draft, I don't think it had any Vickers machine gun training. I know I had. And in Jamaica, prior to our getting there, the battalion had at times, not the whole battalion, because some of them had to stay on internment camp guard. But I would imagine companies went to Montpelier, as it was termed. It's an area. I think now it's a resort area. But they went to the Montpelier area and went on maneuvers training. What went on there, I can't tell you because it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
No, and not in Montpelier, no. The extent of our training in Jamaica was a further extension of what we've had, the more accurate use of the weapons we did have, and we're accustomed to the Lee Enfield rifle and being that's all. And other than that, it was internment camp guard. We had to learn to fend for ourselves if we went downtown in Kingston. They used stones from dark alleys and ice picks, and we became very proficient at the use of our web belts folded with the buckles. So I'll tell you, they sure could cause a nasty cut on those fellows down there.
I've been told that quite a few men did actually become sick from various diseases.
It's like anything in Jamaica.
In Jamaica.
Well,
dengue fever
and malaria. And
social diseases,
we'll name them if you wish. Gonorrhea and syphilis. Mm-hmm. We won't even take it out of there. Right?
No, we don't.
Eh?
You can leave that, right?
Well, sure. They like anywhere else where there's armed forces, this is a natural occurrence. It's not just that it was Jamaica. It had the same thing that's prevalent in Canada today when we were in Canada in the first years of the war. Only it was more talked of then. We were medically, in some camps you couldn't go to camp without prophylactic kit, a tube of Calomel ointment and three condoms.
Was this issued as you left?
Oh, yeah, and in some camps you couldn't get out of them without having them. You couldn't get through the gate with your pass without having them. You had to pick them up at the orderly office. If they were used, chances are a man would guard against them. And it had to be because 99 out of 100 men in Jamaica and in Canada were going out for what they were after. And
the reason I ask is that I understand that there were reinforcements sent down to Jamaica. There were some reinforcements picked up here in Winnipeg before the Grenadiers went to Hong
Kong. Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, those of us that went to Jamaica, I think I was the only one that had I won't call it a bogus number, but a number that wasn't the Winnipeg Grenadier Regimental number. My number is H41687, which is the Royal Winnipeg Rifle number. And when they had gone to Sherbrooke, Quebec to train, I was the only Grenadier that would have been on the district depot on Water Street. And they couldn't keep a complement of one Grenadier there, so they gave me a Winnipeg Rifle number. And that's the way it's ended up. When they come back from Jamaica, I get into the draft, onto the draft. Or when they come back from Sherbrooke, rather, I get into the draft to go to Jamaica. When we come back from Jamaica and left to go overseas, we were under strength because we had a number of men that were categorically health-wise, their health wasn't such that they couldn't go overseas. And we picked up a number of recruits, reinforcements here in Winnipeg. From talking to some of them, they were asked to volunteer, you, and you. This is the way it went. My brother-in-law, my present brother-in-law, was one of them, and George had only been in the Army, I would think, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before he went away. All across Canada, we picked up some in Regina. I guess we picked up some in Calgary, all the way up.
Now, did you know where you were going when you left? Did you have any idea?
Well,
I just remember.
Officially, we were told we were going to BC to forget the name of the camp out there, to stop and think now, Squamish, to for further training. And, when we got on the train, we had a damn good idea that it just wasn't there because they had guards on the doors and everything else. You couldn't even put a postcard off because by this time we knew. We'd been told that we were going to get on ship when we got to Vancouver. But it wasn't until we got on ship that we actually knew where we were going. And, well, there was some all the way across. Whenever the opportunity arose, they jumped the train. I don't know whether you've heard the story about Vancouver on ship, where the Grenadiers were supposed to have mutinied. Some of our better, how can I put them? I won't give them a title. But some of our fellows have claimed that the mutiny, it wasn't a mutiny, it was a case of, in Sid Barco's book, he's got a story in there, Nothing But Mutton. It was the SS Awatea, the ship, an Australian ship, and that's the supplies they had on it, was sheep. And if you've ever smelt tripe cooking, you know what it was. And we got on ship in the morning before dinner. And when we found out what dinner was, we decided that the Air Force had gone on, walked off ship in Nova Scotia and Halifax, and we were going to do the same thing. And I would say there was 70 of us walked off, but it wasn't that we didn't want to go overseas or anything else. It was to get conditions changed. And if I'm not mistaken, Neil Bardell, Captain Bardell, then, was one of them, one of the officers that came off and convinced us we should get back on. But in that group that got off, there must have been 10 or 12 got off for that purpose. They took off. We never saw them again. And They turned themselves in later, and all they got was 28 days. They weren't charged with desertion.
Do you remember what equipment you personally took along with you?
Military-wise?
Yeah.
We had our bayonets, sidearms, our Lee Enfield rifles. None of us had a Thompson submachine gun, although there was Thompsons on ship, because when we got on ship, we all went through the course on the Thompson submachine gun and the Bren gun. But and our Vickers guns naturally were on board. But that's about it. Anybody that had a revolver sidearm may have had it. Anybody that had a someone carried knives extra. I can't remember his first name, but Lance Corporal Andrews from up Hamiota Russell way now. He had a knife he carried in his along his leg. But I think that could be picked up in Jamaica because of the problems down there. But that would be it. And our any other equipment that had been issued at that time, our webbing carried to carry our ammunition. We had no ammunition with us at this point. We got that over there.
So you're on a boat bound for somewhere you really didn't know.
Bound for Hong Kong. We knew, to finish the story, after we got on back on ship, after Bardell talked us back on, they pulled the gangway up and they pulled out into the harbor that afternoon. And we anchored out there. And the next morning, just when we moved out, we pulled out from the date, I guess, we left Winnipeg on May. We left Winnipeg on the 25th of October. We left Vancouver on the 28th, if my memory serves me correct. And we landed in Hong Kong on the 17th of November.
Do you remember much about crossing? Was it rough or smooth? Were you sick at all?
No.
Have you ever been on the ocean before?
Never been on the ocean before, but I've been on Lake Winnipeg years ago. I'm not going to, medically, I guess I'm wrong, but to me, seasickness is partly a case of mind. If you want to let it bother you, it'll bother you and make you sick to your stomach. You can do that with anything. You can make yourself sick to your stomach. The roll of the ship just makes it that much more so. But we had, I can't recall what it would be. We had some rough days, but I never went without eating and was never sick.
And you finally went some training?
Well, on ship, we went through...
I just wondered what kind of a routine would be established.
The which?
What kind of a routine would be established?
Well, we went... our normal course of training, there was no left turns and right turns and saluting by numbers, but they trained us in the Bren gun in this sense. Well, we didn't actually fire it until we get into action. We knew the problems of a Bren gun being jammed and the ways and means of unjamming them or getting them back to work again. Bren gun is a very simple mechanism. Clearing a jam was much more simpler clearing it than a Vickers gun or a Lewis submachine gun, a Lewis machine gun. And likewise a Thompson. We also had the same thing with a Thompson. Everybody had to be familiar with it, but we didn't fire it until we get it back. And likewise with the mortars. The 3-inch mortar went to a mortar platoon, but each platoon itself had their own 2-inch mortar. And we had men in the platoon that were given the job of learning. We all went through the training of it. But how to sight them and everything else, their sight on them, I think the term is lensatic. It's a lensatic sight. It was just a V-notch sight that you angled, that's all. And as you turned the sight, the mortar either went up or elevated up or elevated down, one or the other. That's all it did.
Do you remember when you first heard about going to Hong Kong?
Well, the only thing I can recall is that trying to think of our platoon officer at that time. It wasn't Mitchell. He came to his after. We were told that we might have to fight our way off ship. This was the way it was put to us. I can recall that. This was on ship, yeah. When we got, they told us we were going to Hong Kong and we'd have to fight our way off. We might have to fight our way off. And we knew that by then that it was the Japanese, that chances are we'd be tangled with nothing else.
Did you know much about the Japanese? I guess you would be hearing quite a bit in those few days if you were going to...
Well, we knew... we did know that Canada was sending them all the scrap iron they could sell them. And some of our fellows that come from the farm country used to say, after we were taken prisoner, that their dad's old plowshare that he'd sold for scrap was thrown back at him in a Japanese shell or a mortar bomb. There was a shipload of, when we pulled into Honolulu, there was a shipload of Japanese nationals then on their way back to Japan. That would be maybe a week out from Vancouver, if we hit Hawaii. And we pulled in and berthed on one side of the dock, and they were perhaps 400 yards away across on the other, on a, I forget the name of it, either one of their Maru line boats. But there was a lot of them on there. And I guess some of the fellows shook the fist at them the way they normally do. Nevertheless, we didn't know whether we'd have to fight our way off or not. We thought, I guess, you would come to resign to something like that. The way I put it now, we'll play it by ear and see what happens when we get there. Luckily enough, we didn't have to fight our way off.
Do you remember arriving at Hong Kong?
Well, I do, because I didn't get the chance to march with the rest of them. I got dinged. Alphabetically, in the Army, when a job come up, a fatigue job or a job come up, they took them alphabetically. It's all right on paper aid or anything like that, but for a work job, I think they took a sprinkling of A's, B's, and C's down the alphabet to the work party to unload the kit. We didn't have kit bags that were stored down below. Kit bags. That had your blankets and your personal effects in it. We loaded them. They were brought up out of the hold, and we would throw them onto the dock and then onto the trucks. And we rode up in the trucks. We didn't have to march. But it was a funny thing. Perhaps you've already got that information. It was supposed to be secrecy that we were landing in Hong Kong. And you've heard the story, I guess, about having the shoulder patches torn off. Canada and the Grenadiers were supposed to be taken off for this march to camp. And lo and behold, when the fellas started to march up, I guess they had banners up, the Canadians welcoming them to Hong Kong. And the stories in the paper were the same. It was well publicized over there, but this is the way things go, though.
When you arrived and loaded your equipment in the trucks, would these be Grenadier trucks, or would they be?
No, they were British Army vehicles and Chinese, I guess, vehicles they rented. Oh, our transports and our own Bren gun carriers that we should have had never did arrive in Hong Kong. They claim that they were sidetracked, but my personal feeling is that the damn things were never loaded on a ship and ever sent. I don't know. Like everything else, we had no artillery or anything else for that matter, as far as the vehicles. But these would be British Army vehicles and Chinese trucks for rented transport. This
camp. You arrived in Hong Kong. You didn't have to fight your way off the boat. And you unloaded equipment on the trucks, and then you would go to the camp.
Yeah, this is the Shamshipo.
Yeah. Do you remember any first impressions of Hong Kong, what it was like?
Well,
maybe just even going through the streets and into the camp.
My first impression was looking at the nice I will call it clear water, but the water at the harbor where we were docked, the berth where we were docked, and the scale and scum that was on the big timbers rising and lowering of the tide would cause this. And the smells we've never smelled before, even in Jamaica. You've got terrific smells down there, but nothing like the smells in Hong Kong. Whether my nose was more sensitive or not, I don't know, but this is the first thing that struck me. And the camp was much the same. There's some of them used to claim that their dads had better barns at home, but it was an old-time British Army camp laid out in a square that actually, I guess, could have housed 3 or 4 battalions. And it was set aside for the Canadians and then still recruit. We slept on the same old iron beds that we had in Jamaica, British Army beds. They were.
You brought these with you?
No, these were there. Each piece would be about 3 feet wide and about, I guess I would say, 4 feet long, and one slid in under the other, sort of a Toronto couch affair, only they were just singles. And you black iron, and there was no springs, there were steel slats about 3 inches wide, and then the gap between another 3-inch slat. And on those you had 3 biscuits, as we call them, which formed the mattress. And you'd pull your bed out from the bottom and spread your mattress or the biscuits out, and you had a mosquito netting above it. And you had some of them had barracks boxes, some of them didn't, but you had a spot to put your kit. And I wasn't in Chantrepo that often. We were only there from the 17th of November until the 8th of December, the 8th over there, 7th, before we moved into the defensive positions on the island. But our company and our platoon in particular a number of times was sent over to
this was D Company?
D Company, and you've got me if you ask me the platoon number, but Lieutenant Eric Mitchell was our platoon officer then.
And you were the rank of
private. I had dropped my rank to go to Jamaica. When I qualified as a gas inspector and a PT instructor, I was elevated from Lance Corporal to Corporal, and they tried to talk me out of it. Brandon and told me that if I stayed, I'd eventually get Sergeant Slate's promotion with it. But that, to me, was hogwash. I wanted to get away. But that's another story. But we went on pillbox manning exercises. If I'm not mistaken, 3 times.
Now, would this be on Hong Kong Island?
On Hong Kong Island. Let me get my big map and I can show you a better
picture. A few days after you got there?
Well, not a few days after we got there. I think within a week. We were there a week and they moved us up to Wong Nishong Gap up here. And
That's Wong Nishong Gap?
Wong Nishong.
Right.
Wong Ni. WongNeiChong. And there would be a pillbox right on the corner here of the this is Black Link Road along here. And this is the Wong Nishong Gap Road. This is the only road that went right across the island, cut the island in half. Go on, Gabby. And then pillbox 3 was here. Pillbox 2 and 1 and 2 were over here, just on the edge of Jardine's Lookout. There were all catch basins, cement catch basins to catch the rain to drain it into the different reservoirs.
From Jardine's Lookout.
Yeah, the number 1 and 2 would be over in here, right above Happy Valley, almost above Happy Valley.
Now, was that the name of the valley that ran along?
This is the Happy Valley Racetrack. Happy Valley here. Oh, here's the racetrack right here.
Oh.
And the pillboxes were, I can't tell you what level they were on, but they were in this area, and we could look out down over Layton Hill, Happy Valley, and over the racetrack, and down over the filter bed.
And brigade headquarters is marked on here, too, for you, Ross.
Oh, that's all it is,
that's
too.
That's where Lawson, Brigadier Lawson was killed.
Yeah.
So, after about the first week, you were taken to Hong Kong Island, like, and...
Yeah, and we weren't didn't go into Pillbox 3 at that time. There was two sections of us. Were, well, the whole platoon, we took over section, Pillbox 1 and 2. That was just off Jardine's lookout, looking out over Happy Valley and over the racetrack. And we'd spend 3 days there, I guess. I can tell you a little more about that later. And the rest of the company were spread in their defenses, training defenses places up along brigade headquarters and along the Wong Nishong Gap Road.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the platoon that had pillbox number 3, but we were up there. I know we were up there at least twice on manning exercises, as they were called. And then the third time we went up, they issued us ammunition, and we knew that the war was coming. But we ended up then, instead of going to pillbox 1 or 2, we went to pillbox number 3. And it's strange. Vickers guns were in the ports, the portholes for firing, in the pillboxes. And in 1 and 2, the fellows that were going to work the Vickers guns, the guns were fixed on the tripods in the slits. And they, I would say this, like we ended up in pillbox 3. They had all their gradients and distances. They had a good idea of a mark over there was 600 yards away, and if they had to drop their sights down or up, they used that as a means of identification. And they were reasonably accurate. Well, here we get into pillbox number 3 when we go up to go into action, and they had to start all over again in other spots. This is a how will I put it? I'll call it a botch up, yeah. Not the other. But that's what happened. And this would be on after church parade on the December 7th over there.
You went to church?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now this would be on Hong Kong? Or?
On, you know, on the mainland, in Kowloon, in Shafshapo.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And right after church parade, anybody that was going out of camp were free for the afternoon, and some of them took off. Those that were going to eat stayed, and then we were going to go after. And all of a sudden, we were advised that all leaves were passes were canceled, and they sent the our own garrison MPs out, Grenadier MPs out, to pick up our fellows and get them back to camp because we were going on manning exercises, as it was termed. And this followed a blackout, Saturday night blackout, practice blackout. The colony was entirely blacked out to see what it would look like in blackout. We had a couple of battles in the sun there, too. But anyway...
this is during blackout?
No, the battle of the sun was fought prior to that. We marched over to the magazine that was on the corner of the main road coming in from the gate and the main road through the camp. And each platoon and section was issued their boxes of ammunition, bandoliers of cloth bandoliers of 303 ammunition. And when that was issued, we knew damn well that this just wasn't an ordinary manning exercise because they'd never issued us with ammunition before. And there we climbed on the trucks and went down to the harbor and got on a ferry and ended up in Pillbox 3.
Do you remember how much ammunition? Were you allotted so much ammunition?
I can't remember how many rounds would be in a bandolier. Clips would hold 5. There was a double slot bandolier, so there'd be 10 rounds in each slot, two clips. And the bandolier, if you were to spread it out, would be perhaps 5 feet long. And 3 feet of that would be cloth without slits that would went around your back, or to carry it over your shoulder or fold. There'd be about 2 feet of clips I would assume there'd be 100 rounds in each bandolier, roughly. I can't recall. And a magazine, ammunition pouch would hold, perhaps folded, would hold about the equivalent of a 2 bandoliers. We were issued more after we were got up there, but this was our initial issue.
Did you take any food with you at the time?
No. We had our own, in our brigade, below brigade headquarters, in the company headquarters position at Wang Dishong Gap, down the side of the hill, we had our own kitchen, and this is where our company cooks would set up their kitchen, and their food supply would... food was there, such as it was, and we carried it back and forth in big aluminum steel closed-in Dixies from pillbox to pillbox.
Well, you weren't too far from the headquarters.
Well, though. No, but to get there, to get from pillbox 1 and 2 over to the camp kitchen at company headquarters, you had to walk around the drainage ditch and come over... this is the Wang Dishong Reservoir.
That's right.
To the reservoir road to Stanley Gap here, around this way, and then down the road and back in here. And that's 30 years ago, almost, a little more. The distance would be, if you could walk down the side of the hill and across, you would be within 500 yards of company headquarters. But going around the way we went, I would estimate it would be maybe a mile walk around. But I guess we could have gone straight across, but carrying Dixies loaded with soup and stew and everything else, you had to keep them on a level.
What was a Dixie like?
Well, a Dixie, a closed-in Dixie like that, was like a... I don't know whether you've ever seen them.
No,
was an ice cream, an aluminum steel, aluminum plated ice cream container. It'd be about a quarter inch thick, about 10 to 12 inches in diameter. And it had a top on it that screwed down tight, and it was sealed. And it kept the food reasonably hot.
How much food did you eat in there?
When we were on manning exercises, 1 and 2, pillbox 1 and 2, we would have about, there'd be roughly 30 men in the 2 pillboxes, 15 in each. So there'd be soup in one and whatever else we were getting, bread or potatoes, mostly stew and coffee.
Now, could one man?
No, it'd be a party of 3 men.
Mm-hmm.
One on each end and one in the center. And, if it was dry rations, you carried them on, you could pack them on your back. But to carry those things would be 12 inches in diameter, as I say, and maybe not far off 30 inches high.
What kind of food were you getting in
there? Well, regular
stew. And
oh, yeah. The Army made pretty good stew.
Yeah.
Basically, there's nothing wrong with Army food as long as you've got a good cook preparing it. And he knows how to prepare it for X number of men, but if you've got a cook that's accustomed to cooking for 5 or 6 people, and all of a sudden he has to cook for 230 in a company, you've got a problem. He gets either too much salt or pepper, or too much of this, or not enough of that, that's all. But we had some good cooks. And let's put it this way, when you're hungry and working and exerting effort, you... even though it's not too good, it tastes good. It's filling and it warms your stomach, and this is all you're after. We had ice cold showers at company headquarters. Very seldom was there any hot water, but if you wanted to have a shower, you could walk around when you had time off and go and have a shower.
Did you get your water from headquarters too? Do you know how you got it?
I have to stop and think. Yes, our water was our water would be trucked up, because the water, you end up with dysentery or something, drinking water out of the straight out of the reservoir, because it drained off all the hills. The water would be, I would assume they may have, our kitchen may have got it from there, but it was dechlorinated and everything else. It was clean and drinkable. But the water would come from there, from our company.
You did carry a water bottle?
We had water bottles, yeah. Not all of us had water in it. Some of us preferred rum, and some would have rum in their water bottle.
Now, you mentioned that you had taken ammunition and you went to the pillbox. Do you remember when war started? Do you remember how you knew that war had started?
Yeah. In the Army, you do 2 hours on and 2 hours off if you're on guard duty. And luckily enough, I wonder where you want to put it. I'm trying to think of his name. His first name. No? His last name was Till. He was originally from up around Swanford, Minnetonka. He and I were on guard duty from 4 until 6 o'clock the morning of the 8th. That's the Monday morning. And we had a little sentry post dug in up on top with a Bren gun. And the other man would be down below in the underbrush. And this is the way he and I worked. And the phone rang, and it was my turn down below in the brush, and I went in and answered the phone, and I can't recall who it was, but they wanted Lieutenant Mitchell. And I woke him up, and he answered the phone, and the phone rang, and it was for, yes? And as I say, the telephone call was for Lieutenant Mitchell, and Eric Mitchell, and he answered it. When he hung up, he said, well, boys, this is it. We're at war with Japan. This would be just before we were to change guard in the morning, maybe 5:45. And just then, day was starting to break, and we could hear airplanes in the sky and the anti-aircraft guns and pom-poms on the ship. And everybody ran out en masse and climbed up on the hill where our Bren gun was. And we stood out on the Bald Hill watching them bomb Kai Tak Airport and the other installations that they were bombing. And there was no resistance other than the anti-aircraft. We had Tiger Moths over there, but that's about the extent of the RAF's.
Did they get off the ground? Did you see
no.
them take off?
None that I know of. The Japanese even shot down the Pan American Clipper that was loaded with Pan American Airways had a flying boat that flew Trans-Pacific,
mm-hmm.
and this was almost loaded with passengers ready to scoot out, and it was destroyed. Now, I don't think there was any loss of life, but there was a loss of a lot of mail and everything else that was going to happen.
So you would be up here somewhere?
I'm going to get my glasses. No, we're not on Jardine's lookout. We'd be up here. This time we're in Pillbox 3.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
We were on the slopes of Mount Nicholson, you might call it. This is the high point. But Mount Nicholson just slopes down to the road. And the pillbox was on, as I say, on the corner. And up behind it, there was very little growth on it up there. I call it it's a volcanic. To me, it's nothing but a volcanic ash. It was very, not chalky, it was sharp and would hurt, but you could, it was hard to dig in, unless you had a pick and shovel. Reddish clay, if you want to call it that. And we just stood up there and watched them bombing the installations across the harbor.
Do you remember where the airport would be?
Yeah, Kai Tak. Is right up in there. Well, here.
North end of Kowloon Bay, I guess.
Where are we? Gindrinker's Line. North Point. I'm showing you on the other map. Then I'll give you the whole thing. It's marked on there. Kai Tak Airport.
All right.
Straight across.
So from your position, you have a pretty good view of all...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. See, we were... You could look right through across Happy Valley from the corner here, right to the airport, and they hit the dockyards. And while we didn't see it, apparently they hit some of the Texaco Oil Depot tanks over here.
Oh, they would be out.
Well, they're marked right here. Oh, Texaco Depot tanks right there at 259. And we had a full view then of the bomb, the planes. I don't think at that time they hit any of the installations on the island itself. If they did, it was out of sight of us. Mm-hmm. Be around the other way.
Well, for the next, do you remember what you did for the rest of that day? It'd be a pretty hectic day, I think.
Yeah, it was. We dug up on this top. We dug some more. We call them pits. They call them foxholes later on in the war. But they were pits to us, defensive positions, where if it had come down to, which it finally did do, a landing on the island, there wouldn't have been that many men in the pillbox, though those that weren't on Vickers guns would be up in the up on the top around to defend the approaches to the pillbox. And these are what these holes were for. We did a... We also dug over by the police station. We dug another pit that we mounted our Bren gun on, a tripod, for anti-aircraft. And there again, you were back. If you weren't on guard duty on the pillbox or in that area, you did 2 hours in the... Two of you would do 2 hours in the hole on anti-aircraft duty. And... aircraft duty. And as time went on, that would be the 8th. On the night of the 9th, they mobilized D Company. We were termed, D Company was termed a mobile company and mobile reserve. And they brought up some Chinese trucks, and D Company piled onto the trucks, and they brought up another company to take over our defensive positions, and we went to the mainland to fight a rearguard action. We went over to reinforce the mainland, the company. And Major Hook was our... Major Bowman was our company commander, a former high school teacher, Daniel Max.
Do you remember what you thought of your officers and non-commissioned officers?
Well, I'll put it this way, and I'll be quite frank. I can mention names. As far as our NCOs were concerned, they were all good fellows. The two Lieutenant Phillips were good officers. Lieutenant Eric Mitchell, while he was young, he was only 21, not much older than those of us, and some of us in the platoon were older than he was. They were good officers. But I won't say much more for Captain Bowman. As a high school teacher, I guess his qualifications were next to top. But as a leader of men, I'll put it this way, he didn't have my respect. He did because he wore a uniform and was company commander, but that's as far as it went. And I guess right or wrong, we have had to obey his orders. Anyway, we went over to the mainland, and they moved us into the cricket club. I can't show you where that is on there, but if I had a detailed map of the city of Kowloon, we could. And we spent the rest of the night there without blankets, woke up the next morning with no food, we had no rations with us. And
You took your arms and ammunition?
Oh, yeah, we took those, and our Bren guns, and those that had Thompson submachine guns,
but
everything.
But no blankets?
No blankets, no kit, just battle goal. And they told us chances are we'd be fighting a rearguard action for them pulling out when the evacuation came. Because by this time we knew the mainland would be evacuated. And Eric Mitchell in our platoon, the whole company was here. spread around. And we were bloody hungry. And we gathered up what money we could in our platoon, money that was available in Hong Kong currency. And he wanted somebody to go and see what they could find to buy. So yours truly shoved up his hand and I went. I wanted to get out of that area. So I wandered through, I can't even tell you the streets, but I wandered down a number of streets into some of the different stores. Some were closed up by this time. But I couldn't buy anything. The prices were, their prices had just gone up. Couldn't even buy chocolate. And just then, an English officer came along. I don't know whether he was attached to the Indian troops or what. I can't even recall his name. And he asked me what I was doing there, and I told him. And he says, well, you come with me. He says, we'll get you something. So we went into about four stores, and he spoke Chinese fluently. And I bought biscuits and whatever else I could and went back with a haversack full of something to eat, and mostly chocolate bars. And we ate that up, and finally the word come, we were moving out, and trucks come along, and we moved up to a point on, I have to get my map here, we moved up to above what was our old Champshapo camp here, mm-hmm. on the Taipo Road. I would say we moved into this position somewhere in here. It was almost directly above the camp, into shelter. The idea was, as I say, how far up we were going to move, we didn't know, but it was to fight a rearguard action for the Royal Scots when they pulled out. And finally they moved us further up, and we moved into this position here because we were just below these reservoirs here. Mm-hmm. And unknown to us at that time, the Japanese had already almost taken Golden Hill, which was just across the other side, and they had taken the Shingman Redoubt here and broken up Gindrinker's defense line, and they never moved any further. And we sat there until almost dusk, and word had come earlier in the day that when that darkness we would pull out. And this has come back to Captain Bowen. He was killed in action, and all due respects to him. But we were going to get a rum ration issued, and the rum was all gone. Captain Bowman had drank it. So there you have it. Anyway, we pulled out. We only had, there was about four Indian troops and a couple of wounded Royal Scots come down the road. That's all that came down the road.
This is from Gindrinker's line.
Well, where they came from, I don't know. They either come down from up in this area here someplace. Right. But Gindrinker's line ran across this way. You have it on there too, I think,
yep.
Your Shingman Redoubt mark. At that, just before that, we pulled out early in the afternoon. Captain Goldman sent Shatford and Paulson, I guess it was. Paulson. Shatford and Paulson up towards the reservoir on a scouting trip. We didn't see them again until we go back to the mainland, because or to the island, because in the meantime, before they got back, we pulled out. And
they were going out to scout around?
Yeah, on a scouting trip to see what was up ahead. And they did run into Royal Scots. This is who they came out with, Royal Scots and Indian troops that had been knocked off of Golden Hill. And we started down this road, and a Hong Kong volunteer Bren gun carrier come up and pass through us, and we hedgehopped down. One section would stop and set up a defense, and the rest moved through, and we just hedgehopped that when you will get down, the next one was set up, and so on.
They were that close behind?
Oh yeah, they had just moved down the road right behind us, and we get down below, and there was no transportation for us, and it was a long walk to the dockyard. Anyway, somebody commandeered a couple of Chinese trucks, and the company piled on their end mass hanging all over, and we drove down to the Navy Yard and got on ship and on a ferry and went across. But we pulled out into the harbor. It was dark by this time, and when we had got into the Navy Yard, there was a Hong Kong policeman there with a shotgun, and he was staying. And our ship, our ferry, pulled away from the dock, and I guess you might say we were lost in the darkness, and they were there because he was shooting We never did see him again. But they shot at us as we crossed on the ferry with their little mountain guns. They were the ones that blew our pillboxes to pieces, too.
Mountain gun?
Blunt, Happy.
Mountain gun?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be, the wheels would be about 2.5 feet in diameter. When they packed it, one man would carry a wheel, another man carried the axle, and one would carry the, I guess you'd call it a breech block, it wasn't an artillery man, and the other would carry the barrel. And this is the way they transported their gun, and they could put it together in a matter of minutes. And this is what they were shooting at us with. We saw those guns later in the hills in Hong Kong. But this one would be already mounted on their wheels. They just followed along.
So you come back to the island.
Mm-hmm. We landed in the Navy Yard on the other side, on Hong Kong.
Would you be about the last troops to leave?
No. I would say that we maybe were the last large body of them to leave. The next morning, there were still Indian troops. Well, there was Indian troops stayed on here. Devil's Peak. There was Indian troops here, I think, 3 days after the whole island had been evacuated. They came off later. But there was... there'd be small pockets of men left that still had to come out. And the ferries were there, the boats were there waiting for them. And there's a story, I don't know his name, but an Englishman or a Hong Kong volunteer, an Englishman or an Australian policeman, that was at the dock waiting. These fellows were coming through and getting them on ship. And he yelled to this group coming along on the double because he wanted to get out too. And then he realized they were Japanese troops that he took off and got away. But there was isolated cases where some of them swam across the harbor where there was no ships left. And the Japanese just took over the mainland. That's just about the way it went. We pulled out, that would be the 11th, we pulled out the 11th, 12th. And on the morning of the 12th, we were at, they took us, D Company, to Victoria Barracks. That was, then they had to decide where they were going to put us. Then they moved E Company out, that had moved into our defenses. That won the Sean Gap and moved us back in.
You went back in?
Yeah. A little more to that story yet. We went back in there then, and that was our position until the...
What pillbox did you go back into?
We went back into pillbox 3. Pillbox number 3, right at the gap. And then our Wong Ishang Gap was under constant shelling. Oh, I would say for a period of an hour and a half every day at noon.
Yeah, do you know where the shelling would be?
Yeah, oh, you could see it. But there was nothing we could do about it. When we could go out on where are we? This one. We could go out on Mount Nicholson, mm-hmm. where we had these slopes. And you could look across the harbor. You'd be looking across from almost from this position here, and they had their guns in their big artillery in the Chinese godowns, the warehouses, and this is what they were shooting straight through the roof.
Yeah.
This is all it was, and I remember Till and I were in this anti-aircraft position, and the old story, as long as you can hear them, you know there's nothing coming your way. And they hit the police station, which would be maybe 75 yards below, and a couple of times, and they hit the area around it. But they more nuisance than anything else, and you just had to keep your head down in your hole.
Do you know if they were shooting at anything in specifically?
No, I think they were hitting the road. They hit the road in a few spots and blew holes in the road. But as I say, as long as you could hear them coming, you knew they were missing it. And then, I don't know how long, but there was a space of time when we heard nothing. And then just a thump. And this dust and dirt just sprayed into this hole, even through the netting we had up. Well, I don't know how long it took Till and I to get back to Killbox, but we sure moved. It was a dud, and it just hit, and that was it. Now, how far away it was, we don't know. Taffy! get out of there. I don't know how far it was away. But it scared us. Like everybody else, we all had scares at times.
Had you seen any Japanese by this time, do you know?
No, I can't say we did. On the evacuation of the main line, going down that road, it was dark. Yeah. And any firing was fired at flashes, let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. We never did get into that close contact with them. We didn't see any Japanese until after they landed on the island. But that, well, that would be up until the night of the... have to stop and think now, when they landed, 18th, 19th. We were taken prisoner on the 19th. They landed on the night of the 18th, give or take, I would say around 10 o'clock. And again, like everything else, when they landed on the island, they moved our platoon out of our pillbox and moved a platoon in from Kingdom Come, I don't know where they come from, don't know who they were, in to take over the pillbox.
Would these be grenadiers?
Yeah, they were from E Company, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And they took over the pillbox, and it was our job to go to, we were to go to Stanley Gap and on the edge of Jardine's Lookout. Stanley Gap's right in here. Just below Jardine, between Violet Hill and Jardine's Lookout. We were to go up Jardine's Lookout to reinforce the men that were there. They had called for reinforcements. So in the meantime, you know what had happened. The Japanese had landed and just moved, started to move right in, and they needed reinforcements. We didn't know any, we could hear firing and everything else, but we didn't know which was what. And we started down, even though Eric Mitchell didn't know where Jardine's Lookout was. That, I mean, this is what it was. And we went through Stanley Gap, down towards Taitam Reservoir, and an Indian trooper halted us. He was on guard somewhere. And Eric Mitchell went ahead and talked to him and told him who we were and what we were after, and he gave us directions, and we started back. We never did get to Jardine's. We got up on the slopes of Jardine's Lookout, but never up to the defensive positions as to where we were to go. We ended up in that drainage ditch from Pillbox 1 and 2. That's where we were at daybreak in the morning, looking back over towards, we could see our pillbox.
That would be about...
Well, let me get my glasses on. I can't pick out the drainage ditch here, but Stanley Gap's here.
Right.
We would be on the slopes in here someplace, in the drainage ditch. But in the dark, we had moved back into position and had started up the slope of Jardine's Lookout, and Mitchell figured we'd wait until daylight because we had to know where we were going.
Yeah, it was dark, I guess.
It was dark. Oh, yeah, pitch black. And then they'd hit some oil tanks and everything else, and it made it that much blacker. The black smoke was just going all over everything. And at daybreak the next morning, well, by this time, even in the dark, the machine guns at the police station were firing down through Happy Valley, towards Happy Valley, and the tracers were just flying back and forth, and we weren't going to move until we could find out where we were going. Whether we went back to our original position or not remained to be seen. And just at dusk or at daybreak, their Japanese were very adept at camouflage. They all, their forward troops all had netting on them that they could shove grass and everything else into. And I guess it was Tippi McCorriston from Portage. He spotted them. He saw the movement in the, on the slope. And in nothing flat, they were had their knee mortar. They had a small, smaller than our 2-inch, be about 1.5-inch mortar. Two men worked. No sight on it, so the clamp would just go around his knee or around his leg, and he'd hold it and elevate it, and the other fellow dropped the ammunition down. And they were after the Vickers guns at Stanley Gap that were holding them up. And Mitchell yelled for us to fire, and that was it. Well, the moment we revealed our position, the ones that were down below us started after us, so we went over the hill, as we called it, over this way,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up with A Company, who had already, well, A Company had been ordered to move up to help defend Jardine's Lookout. And they, like us, had got lost. we're waiting for daylight. And then we ended up back in here someplace, Ross. We were above the reservoir with A Company, and that's where, just there is where, not long after that, I guess, Sergeant Major Osborne threw himself on the grenade. I wasn't there. We were in that area in that vicinity. But we're on the side of a hill, and I remember, again, as I say, everybody's scared. Sergeant Pugsley ended up with us. We were spread out on this slope of this hill, just below the crest.
That would be down
the land. Yeah, well, on one of these anyway, promontories here, land here someplace. And the Japs were down below on the other side. You could hear them. And we were grenades. We were going to lob our grenades down. And they threw them back at us. They weren't crying. We could have held them in our hands, let the lever go and held them in our hands, and they wouldn't have gone off. There was no primer in the grenade
at
all.
Did you know this?
We didn't know it at that time, no, not until they threw them back. Some of them were primed. Some of them went off down there. And when they started throwing them back, as I say, everybody got scared, and it was just a slide down the slope away from the crest. And when they threw the grenades back, then we realized Pugsley was right. The closer we were to the crest, the better off we were. So everybody scrambled back up to the top. And they come up, the Japanese come up the slope two or three times, but never got too close. Our Bren guns and Thompsons and our own rifles held them back far enough. We never got that close to hand with them. And then Mitchell came back from where he had been, and we had to pull out. Major Gresham, the company commander, A Company, decided we'd pull out and see if we could get back through not so much to safety, but to a stronger position, because we were almost completely surrounded. And we moved down into a pocket, back towards Stanley Gap, and between Jardine's Lookout and, I guess, Violet Hill. And now his name, Captain Tarbutt, Lyle Tarbutt, I think, yeah, Lyle, had been wounded quite badly, and there was three or four of the fellows taking turns carrying him. And incidentally, he was a good officer, too. He told him to leave him in this little crevice, but he wasn't going to make it anyway. And he was just a hindrance to them, and he had his revolver and just illegal, and that's the last we saw him. That was the last we saw of Captain Tarbutt. We can assume the Japs either come along, and he may have shot some of them, but we would assume that in his condition he either died, or if they did come along, he perhaps shot himself. I don't know. We never did. I don't know if his body was ever discovered and buried properly. We moved back further then towards Wong Nishong Gap, down this gully, and towards Stanley Gap and Wong Nishong Gap, and then we ran into more Japanese. And we moved up, it was sort of a horseshoe, and we moved up to the crest. And to estimate numbers now, it'd be hard to say, but after we were taken prisoner, there was almost 100 of us in this building. And most of them were A Company men,
I would estimate on that slope there'd be maybe 150, and of the 150 there was over 50 of them were wounded, and some of them seriously had been carried. And Gresham decided that rather than put them in, we were getting low on ammunition, that best course to be would be to surrender, and he advised us as such. And he started to walk up the top of the crest, and if I recall, it was his hanky he was waving, and he had his revolver in his hand, and they shot him, killed him. And it would be a half hour after that, I guess, one of the Japanese officers come over, and he realized then that this is what was going to happen. Which officer it was that had taken over when Gresham was killed, I don't know. I can't recall, but in the interim, we continued our little battle with them back and forth. And by this time, I had a Bren gun, which was difficult to fire because I shoot from the left shoulder, and the sight of a Bren gun is on the left side, and you can't get right down behind it unless it's on a tripod. Anyway, Till was my second on gun. He put the magazines on, and he lays, the second man lays on his back on the, which is my left side of the gun, and when the gun's empty, takes the magazine off and puts the pulling on. And somebody yelled grenades, and everybody ducked, and this thing went off almost on top of him, and there was only one small piece that hit him. Nothing hit me. I was down below him. But it hit him in the stomach, and he started to bleed, and we put a dressing on it, a field dressing kit on it. And it stopped the bleeding somewhat. But he subsequently died after in Argyle camp from loss of blood, nothing more. And just after that, they come over and took us prisoner. They disarmed us, took our shoes and took our belts, all our pictures, wristwatches.
Was there much fighting done at this time? Of course, you would.
Well,
you'd almost try to surrender once.
Yes, and this was the course that was followed. Keith Geddes, one of them, he decided he wasn't going to be taken prisoner. We were leery because we'd always heard stories about the Japanese, and they'd never taken prisoners in China. And this is what we assumed would happen. And we felt that before that what we should do is maybe hold out until dark and carry the wounded with us. And Gresham said no, that we wouldn't be able to manage, and that was it. But Geddes took off, and I guess he used a couple of gullies, and he must have got half a mile away in the meantime, starting up the edge of Jardine's lookout. And they sent a couple after him, but he was long legged, he got away. And he eventually ended up with one of the other companies, and subsequently was wounded again and taken prisoner. But they moved us down then to Stanley Gap. There was some buildings down there. And as I say, they took all our valuables, wristwatches and belts and everything. We had our hands up, and if you took your hands down, they'd nick you in the back with a bayonet. And at this time, it's just about then, is when they pulled out, I have a letter to answer here, my gosh. We had a tall, gangly young fellow from St. Laurent. His name was Delorier. I can't remember his first name. And they disliked tall men, I'm assuming this. They pulled him out and two or three others. And we never saw them again, but they used them for bayonet practice all night long. We could hear them. And eventually, I guess they killed them. But at the same time, you may have got this story from Roy Stogill. He was there too, enough you could talk to him about, I can't remember the land, Howard Land, I think it was. His brother had been killed just prior to being taken prisoner, or Howard being taken prisoner. And how he had done it, I don't know, but Land concealed a grenade. And he just walked into this group of Japs and let the grenade go. It He was killed, but he wounded and took a lot of the Japanese with him. And they moved us then into this building, and we spent the night in there. And all night long, they continually moved men into it. That was at Stanley Gap up in here, the position we had moved away from in the morning. And,
Do you know about what date this would be?
Well, this would be the 19th then, late in the afternoon of the 19th. Well, it was dark by the time we went into the building. In the morning of the 20th, the rest of A Company that had been held back in their position were ordered to move ahead to had the mortar, 3-inch mortar section. And they located the Japanese at Stanley Gap, but they didn't know there was anybody in the, didn't know we were in the building. And they straddled it where the first one went over, the next one was short, and the next one come through the roof, right, hit the roof right at the corner where the roof slopes down and the wall went up. And we had a large number of wounded in there before that, but Sergeant Pugsley ended up with a pile of slivers in his forehead. That's all that hit him. He was back in the wall. And Eric Mitchell hadn't been wounded, but he got hit in the head and in the legs with shrapnel from the mortar bomb. And his brother Vaughn was there. Vaughn hadn't been hit either then. He wasn't hit that time either. But some of the fragments went across. Those of us that were against the wall, most of them weren't hit. But it went across and sprayed across. And one I remember, Tommy Matty, that's when he was killed. And umpteen others. And just after that, they moved us out and tied us up with our own communication cable. And they tied us up in groups of five, two at front and two at the back and one in the center. And your hands were well up your back, up to the, almost between the shoulder blades, and had another loop around your neck. And if you dropped your hands, it tightened on your neck, or if any one of the other group faltered, it was the same way. And one of the groups, Kilfoyle from, I guess he was from Carlin or Morton, down that way, he'd been wounded. And they got him in the center. And they had to hold him up, but finally he just dropped. And this is after the march is away. And the Japanese just cut him out and tied the other four together there. And they kept Kilfoyle back. And whether they pushed him over the cliff or what, we don't know. But we heard a scream and that was it. So they either bayoneted him or pushed him over. I guess they did both. And
were you getting anything to eat or drink?
No. By this time, we left on the night of the 18th, we left our pillbox. Those of us that had water bottles with us were lucky. Some had water, some had rum in them. But by noon of the 19th, this was all gone. And now this is the morning of the afternoon of the 20th, and we hadn't had anything to eat or drink since the night of the 18th, I might say. And they marched us from there down from Stanley Gap past Titan Reservoir in here. It takes down this road here and across the reservoir and down through here. We ended up in North Point for the night. But on the way, we passed their supply horses and donkeys coming up. And this is my personal experience there. You seem to know when something's going to happen. And this Japanese pulled this pick handle off, a pick handle or an axe handle, off of one of the donkeys or burros or whatever they were, and started to move over towards the line of prisoners. And as I say, you seem to know, and I knew it was me he was going to hit. Whether I showed fear on my face and that's why he picked me or not, I don't know. But he banged me on the head. And if it hadn't been for McCorrister that was behind me and another fellow beside me, I'd have dropped. But they held me up. And it was just the once he hit me, but it was enough to almost... Well, I didn't drop, but close to it. And my head rung for days after. And we passed a catch basin on the
It run around the mountain to catch the drainage water, and in one spot
it was a square cement spot where the water had run into, and it settled. And I would assume almost everybody in that group got a drink of water as they went by it. They let each group stop for one drink. But I think that was the downfall of some of us, because we most likely ended up with history from that later. And we ended up in North Point Camp, which eventually became a prison camp. But at that time, there was no windows on it, in it, or anything else. And it started to rain, and we were able to catch some rain.
Were you untied at this time?
Yeah, they untied us then. They untied us. And Ross, the wire had been so tight. Well, everybody had the same way. Anybody that was tied that way, those marks were on our wrist for almost 2 years after the scars, because it cut right into the flesh. And it was red raw. And we did get some cold cooked rice. Where they got it from, I don't know, but that was it. And they moved us from then there, and that was the night of the 20th. In the morning of the 21st, they put us on a ferry and moved us across to the mainland, to Kowloon. And we went to another Chinese refugee camp. It was called the Argyle Refugee Camp, Chinese refugee camp. I don't know if I can show you it on there or not.
No, we can't.
It would be about where?
Oh, gosh. It could be anywhere in there, but yeah. If I had a, you could pick it out on a Hong Kong, the Kowloon City map.
You went from, it was North Point on
we were, North Point is here on the island, and they took us across by ferry to the mainland. And to, as I say, to this camp, Argyle Camp. Eventually, we used the hill across from it as a cemetery.
Did you walk through the streets of Kowloon to the cemetery?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, pardon me. I said Argyle. We were just above Argyle. It was a Catholic church and Catholic hall we went into first that night, that afternoon and that night, when it was the 21st. And we spent the night in there. We did get some of our, those of us that were lucky enough, they threw in some cans of our old army biscuits and a few cans of bully beef and M&V, meat and vegetable stew, canned. And we did have something and some water. And those that were wounded had a little care given to them.
By the Japanese?
No, by, everybody had field dressing kits. No medical care there yet. Mind you, the Catholic priest and the nuns did what they could. They brought us what they could. But they were handicapped too. The morning of the 22nd, then they moved us into the Argyle camp. And we had a hospital set up then. The wounded, seriously wounded, and everything were moved into there. One thing I didn't mention, Lieutenant McKillop, from Portage La Prairie, had been badly wounded, and as I say, they wouldn't. When we left that building, they wouldn't let us take any. Anybody that couldn't walk couldn't go.
Mm-hmm. And would you be many?
Pardon?
Would you be many that couldn't?
Oh yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Eric Mitchell and Vaughn Mitchell. Vaughn wouldn't leave his brother, and he stayed with him, and we never saw him again. Eric couldn't walk, and they wouldn't let us carry him. And McKillop, he walked. He died in this Argyle camp with loss of blood. And Till was the same way. The exertion opened their wounds, and this was all it was. And they both died. John Gunn died. John had been had a grenade go off between his legs, and it tore all his testicles off. He died from loss of blood too.
Mm-hmm.
There was a number of them in that Argyle camp died. And I guess we set up a little kitchen. They brought in some dry rice. Who knows how to cook rice? Anyway, Kravinchuk, old Sam from Edmonton now, but he came from Cam Kenora, Saskatchewan, originally. Sam did the cooking. He knew how to cook rice. Whether he did or not, I don't know, but he sure did a good job, and he ended up good. And the next day, they moved in the rest of D Company that had been taken prisoner at Wang Nishan Gap. By this time, they'd overran Wang Nishan Gap too. I think they overran it about
the 21st, and those that didn't get away were taken prisoner. Bob Manchester and Bert Caldwell and Billy Kohut. Tommy Marsh, in the meantime, had been taken prisoner on Jardine's lookout, but he ended up coming over there the same way. And anybody that they had caught at Wanganeshaun Gap, they all ended up in Argyle. By then, I guess there must have been 200 of us there. And the morning of the 23rd, we were all awakened by artillery. Artillery was just outside on the flat square behind the camp. And the walls just shook, the dust fell down, and the cement would just bounce every time they'd go off. And they were shelling from there, they were shelling points on the island. The morning of we were there, I guess, till it would be Christmas Day, if I'm not mistaken, that they moved us from there back to Shamshapole. And we were told then that the island had surrendered and that we were going to go over to Shamshapole and fix it up.
Did you know by this time that you were going to be kept as prisoners of war?
Well, we had a fair idea that this is what was going to happen. Where they'd move us to, we didn't know. We thought they'd just move us back into the interior in China. Everybody had his different ideas, different thoughts on it. And they told us they were going to take us to Shamshapole, and we were going to get things set up there for the others when they moved them over. And they left a number of them. The wounded were all left in Argyle. My brother, they kept my brother there. He'd been hit in the elbow and in the arm. Billy Kohut, John Gunn hadn't died up until that time. But they died later, I say. Kohut and my brother and a few of the others did eventually arrive up back in camp with us, but the rest had all passed away. We went over to Shamshapole and into the old Jubilee building, the officers' quarters, and this is where we were when the main gang of prisoners came in from the island. If we were ever going to make an escape, that's when we should have made it, because there was only two guards with us. And we just wandered over the whole camp, back to our old barracks and everything else, to see if the Chinese had left anything there that might be of value to us.
When you left the barracks originally during the battle, and the Chinese had gone through the camp?
Ross, they took everything. The panes, the window, they took the window jams out of the windows, the wood out of the windows, everything. Anything, the iron beds were gone. They moved everything out. There wasn't anything left. They even took the straw thatch off the dining rooms, the long open dining rooms we had with straw and palm thatch. They even took that off. Whether they didn't burn it off, because there was no sign of burn. But they cleaned the whole thing out. In the Jubilee building, where they could, they even removed the plumbing, the toilets and the sinks. The water by this time had been turned off. But
was there any leadership in camp at that time? Was there any officers?
We had no officers. Lieutenant Bob Phillips, I guess. No, he wasn't with us. He was wounded. When we went to Shamshapole, there was no officers with us. We had Sergeant Major Caldwell, Bert Caldwell, our company commander, D Company, and Bob Manchester, Sergeant Manchester. Whatever leadership was. Came from the senior NCOs that were with us. But like the rest of us, we were dazed. And hungry. And at a loss to figure out what might happen to us, that's all. A sense of fear, but not a show of fear, I'll put it that way. Inwardly, you had that feeling of not knowing what was going to happen, but I don't think anybody showed that you could recognize. Again, we set up our own little kitchen, and we had boiled rice, and that's about it. And when the main group come in, then, be about the 26th or 27th, we get back with our own regiment again, and we were all in similar quarters.
you were some of the first ones to arrive at Camp Shimshiko.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We were the first. We were the first.
Do you remember others? Did the others come in big groups or small groups?
No, they pretty well all came in at the same time. The English troops came first. Why, I don't know. They all came from different sections. The Japanese, I guess, on the island gathered them up into different groups. The Canadians come in en masse, both battalions. The numbers of them were there. But they wouldn't be too far spread between them. But mind you, there must have been 80, between 7,000 and 8,000 men would come in there, you see.
That's a lot of men.
Oh, yeah, it sure was. Different areas of the camp were designated to the Canadians and to the British troops and the few Indian troops and the Hong Kong volunteers. Your sections were all laid out. And then we had to go to work and get something to sleep on. Nobody had blankets or anything else. And you just picked your spot on the cement floor and that was it.
Remember any feeling of comradeship at that time when there would be a lot of men coming to camp?
Yes, you mean when we saw these others coming in? Yes. I'll tell you why. We had some, in the time we spent from the time we got into North Point and Argyle and over to Shamshapo, and until we found out that the island had actually surrendered, we felt that we had sergeant majors in our regiment and officers that we felt would it would be almost down to the last man. I mean, Sergeant Major Logan was one that always held the respect of most men, and he still does today. And I think those in C Company would have followed Frank to, if Frank had said we're going to hell, they'd gone to hell with them. I mean, this is what the monster, they like them. And alas, a lot of some of the senior officers were the same way, and most of the junior officers, even though they were much older than some of us, we still had that. They came under the sense of respect and the sense of leadership. They had the leadership quality, and this is what it was. And then when we did see them and found out that so-and-so was still with us and so-and-so was still with us, even though we knew, didn't know how long we were going to be prisoners, there was a feeling of comradeship there when we saw them. And, well, as I said, I left my brother in Argyle. I didn't see him again until, almost August of 1942. That would be from December 41 to August 1942. He was in Argyle, and then they moved him to those that were well removed from Argyle went to Shamshiko. Why, I don't know. And he was attached to, I forget now, but in civilian life before the war, he actually was he'd been a butcher. And he was cutting meat and whatnot for one section of this camp, rationed. He worked in the kitchen. I say cutting meat. What little bit come in? Anyway, they finally brought him and who else? Billy, was it? There's about four of them come over to North Point. In the meantime, they moved us from Shamshiko to North Point. I'm getting ahead of myself. They separated the Canadians from the English troops. I guess it would be I'm going to stop and think, if I may. It would be in January of 1942 they moved all the Canadian troops from that were in Shamshapo from there to North Point. The Royal Rifles were already in North Point camp. And they moved the Grenadiers and the Brigade Headquarters troops that were there to North Point Camp. and kept the Canadians all together. And that would be sometime in January, because from the time we had left Wangnishan Gap on December the 18th until the 29th of January, I'll use the word, if I may, I didn't give a crap. And when I did, from then on, I must have gone 10 to 15 times a day, visited. I've been constipated all that time, and then everything let go. And I went an average then of 10 times a day from then until almost till we were liberated.
Until you were liberated?
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody was the same way. Nobody ever had a hard stool. It was always, well, first of all, it was diet. Mm. Nothing solid. Anyway, we spent from there then until, I guess, the end of August into September, into October of 42, and then they moved us back to Shafter-Pulliton. And all the Canadians were still all together.
What were you doing at North Point?
Those that were working went to the airport. There was British troops went out from Shafter-Pulliton too. We started to build a new runway for the Japanese. This was a Canadian's job, the Englishman, I don't know where they were. But we were laying cement. I would say that when those zeros landed the first time, after that was dry enough for them to land on, the first couple of zeros in just broke the cement up again. Because some of it was laid paper thin. And if you went out to work, I tell you, it was voluntary. You didn't have to go, but those who went out to work got a little more to eat. They got a bun to go out to work. And it was something to do and occupy your mind, and this is why most people would volunteer for it. And they would only kick so many men a day, that's all. And then my dysentery got so bad, and I was down to, 109 pounds, according to my picture there. Mm-hmm. That was taken in when we moved to Japan. But in that time, the officers, by this time, were paid according to the equivalent rank of Japanese pay. They were paid. And they had arranged to have a commissary come in, and they were in the position to spend their money and buy something extra for themselves. And I would say this for them. They did set up a fund, a special dietary fund for those that needed something a little extra to keep them alive. And this was, they set up an extra messing tent, as it was called. And Cliff Matthews and myself, there must have been 10 of us, were lucky enough to get in there. Mind you, all it may have meant was your rice was cooked different, but it had a little sugar in it. And it all tended to help. Well, I got so low at one time with dysentery that I almost gave up the ship. If it hadn't been for my brother and Captain Late, I guess it would have. But I was in a dysentery ward and on a wooden bed with a hole in it, and that's about the size of it. And Ronnie and Captain Late told me that I was going to stay there and if I didn't get up and move around and do something, and I did. I guess I finally shook myself out of it and got up.
I wonder, what kind of food were you eating at the time? Or how much of it did you get to eat a day, if you remember?
Well, it's hard to describe an Indian butter tin. But the size of a salmon tin now. Mm-hmm. An Indian butter tin would be perhaps a wee bit bigger. That coffee mug. We get that twice a day in rice, boiled rice. If there was any vegetable soup or green soup that went along with it, you got that, and it was watery or there was always something to go with it, but that was all. And those that went out to work got that extra bun. But that extra messing did help me after I got out of the dysentery hospital. The doctors were handicapped, Ross. They had a tincture of opium to give you for your stomach, as far as dysentery was concerned. It would help a bit, but it was just it would distemper it. So. You get a little shot of that. And then they moved us back, as they say. They moved us. In the meantime, we had four of our fellows made an escape from North Point. Sergeant Payne and...
From
North Point. Sergeant Payne and Brzezinski, a fellow by the name of Clark, I think, and one of Morrison.
Did many people know that they were going to break up?
No. The only people that knew, the officers knew, because the officers had been asked to from my recollections, it's not first-hand knowledge, and I won't say it's hearsay, but it comes from a good source. They approached the officers on the idea that they were going to make an escape, and they were advised not to. First of all, because they're in a country, they didn't know the language. They were a white man in the yellow man's country. You stood out like a sore thumb. And what they wanted from the officers was some help in food, something they could carry with them, rations, canned stuff, or anything. They were turned down on. Whether the senior officers perhaps had good reason, I don't know, but I feel that they should have given them some help. So consequently, the junior officers did. From my understanding, they did have a revolver and some ammunition. They did get some help from some of the officers. The officers knew it was going to be made, but they didn't know when. The only ones that knew were the fellows that worked in the hospital, because the hospital was outside the electric fence. And the electric fence, at night the gate was closed, the hospital, but the orderlies could come and go. And they built a ladder to go over the fence onto the roof of the hospital in a way, and then the orderlies dismantled the ladder. Red Morgan, I think, was one of them. And destroyed the ladder, put it back to where it was. This is the way they got out. The Japanese never did discover that part of it. But anyway, they were captured almost the same day, the same night they got away. They were captured the next day. And we never knew it. The Japanese kept it quiet. They shot them, gave them a trial and shot them. But the next morning at roll call, we paraded every day for roll call, and those that were sick stayed in their huts. And the company commanders would check their huts to count the number of men in the hut, and the number on parade should jive with the number of prisoners they had. And our feeling after was that the two company commanders involved with this should have kept the fact secret that these men were missing from their companies. But the story goes that they didn't. They turned them in as missing the next morning. And there was a hue and cry, and this was it. But I guess, in the sense, it may have worked out just as well if they'd have concealed the fact. It may have had repercussions on the camp as a whole. I don't know. Maybe this was the reason for doing it. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt. But it wasn't long after that that we signed a pledge that we wouldn't escape.
Was this all the people in the camp?
Oh, yeah, everybody. You were put into groups of 5, or 10, I guess it was. 10 men to a group, and you all signed. And the idea was that if any one of the 10 escaped, they'd shoot the other survivors. We sat on the parade square, I don't know how long, before we signed. Finally, the officers told us that, the brigadier told us that, to sign it, it was for our own good, in that sense, and we were signing under duress. He wouldn't hold anybody back if they didn't want to escape. This is the way he put it. But then he wasn't a grenadier, he was from the Royal Rifles of Canada. Enough said. So we all signed it and get back to our huts. This is what happened.
Were there ever any more escape attempts?
No, not by Canadians, no. Earlier the first early months of prison life, there was a lot of Chinese-speaking Portuguese, Chinese-speaking Englishmen that had been in the colony for years, did escape and eventually got to Chongqing and got away. But there was no barbed wire, no electric fence then and very few guards. And they had access, those men that escaped and made a success of it, had access to help in the colony itself. Chinese friends have helped.
You mentioned that they'd been able to get a gun and some ammunition for mm-hmm. their escape. Were there other things like that in the camp? Were there other guns that had been brought in? You know?
I would think so.
Like a radio?
I can't recollect having any radios in North Point, but there was radios in Shamshapo after we went back. But one thing that did happen in North Point, Colonel Toganaga, the man in charge of the prison camps in that part of the country, up the hill across the road from North Point were his quarters and a big mansion. And there was a sewer drainage ditch that ran through the hills and down past his quarters and through the camp underground. And the opening was in the harbor, and you couldn't get out that way, but in between two of the huts was a big cement manhole cover. Bert Delbridge will tell you this. And this is the way the fellow used to go out. He'd get into the, when the water was low in the harbor, there was no water in through the camp, and you could walk out and up through the storm sewer. And they went through the hills. And they had to quit because I guess the Japanese, from Chinese informers, would find out that there was prisoners out, but they didn't know where and how. And they never did think of this manhole. And the idea was that if you were coming back into camp, you had to be back in at a certain time for those fellows to go out and lift that cover off, get you in.
Was this covered over?
Cement. There's cement top. Well, you see them in parts of the country today, a storm sewer with a cement cast cement top on.
I was just wondering if it had if it was covered over with earth? Or
No, just sitting there between the two huts. But Bert went out a number of times. I went out once. But I say this, I'm not hiding that. I was scared. But at the same time, my strength was such that I didn't want to hinder anybody.
Where would you go?
We went up through to Wang Nishan. Once, the trip I went out on. I don't know where the others went.
Just go out for a walk?
I went for a purpose. We never did get all the way to Wang Nishan. But below the pillbox was an isolated home. I won't call it a mansion, it wasn't that big. But it was an Englishman's home. And before the Japanese landed on the island, we had been using it for shower purposes. It was hot water in it. And we had his permission to use it. And just before, well, we knew it, the landing was coming. We strafed the house. And we hid the kit bag in down the Black Lynx Road in a crevice. And this is what we had gone back for.
What kind of things were in the kit bag?
Oh, there was silverware, there was some watches, and watches were worth money to the Japanese worth. What else? No money. God, any number of things. Mostly silverware and some things that could be used anyway. Razors, anything. But we never did get back there. And Ralph Kelpel, sent me that book. I sent him a map. He went looking for it. But apparently, from the time we put it there, well, after the war, they've cut some of that Black Lynx Road out. They've made a new road through there. And I guess it just disappeared. If I were back over there, I'm going to go and have a look anyway. But some of them went out with a purpose. They were bringing in medical supplies from Chinese and from people that were willing to take a chance on gathering this stuff up for the Canadians. Mostly went out for a lark because it was dangerous, but anybody will know it was the purpose of it. And as I say, then in late fall I moved us back to Shamshapo, and there was not much of a chance of getting out from there. And by this time then we were cutting down the Hill here,
Kai Tech, the airport. The Japanese were filling in a, I guess you'd call it a marsh line, across the Kai Tech Road here. And up in, this is the area they filled in. They were enlarging their airport, the airport, for military purposes. But there was a Chinese cemetery on the hill, and they buried them underground. And it was an old, old one, and they couldn't get the Chinese to work on it because of the fact that it was a cemetery and sacred ground. And they put the Canadians to work on it. And we eventually filled in most of the rice paddy in the swamp. We had a little Chisai railway, as we call it, a narrow gauge railway with push carts. And you filled the box up, and it was pushed out to the end and dumped. And I'll tell you, there was a lot of them we let go and run away, too. But there, if a man was sick, and he worked with five or six men, everybody got a rest, because we, I won't say we dogged it, but we were always on the watch for the guards as they come along. And then the man that was resting, or the men that were resting, would get up and go to work. Because they were always haikoing us, speedo, speedo, hurry up, hurry up, get it done. And I think in most cases, while the work was hard on us, it did us good mentally too, and physically from that point, even though we weren't getting much to eat. And then in 1943 and early in 43, they moved a draft of Canadians to Japan, 500, I guess. And in August of 1943, they moved another gang. But before that, we had a dysentery, a diphtheria epidemic break out in camp. That would be, I guess, in late 42, a diphtheria epidemic break out, and it carried on well into 43. In the meantime, going out to work at the airport, I enjoyed it. And one morning, Bert Caldwell, one afternoon, was one day I wasn't out, Sergeant Major Caldwell called me into his room at the end, the hut, and he said, how would you like to volunteer for hospital early in the diphtheria hospital? I said, no dice, I'm going out to work. He said, well, you're going to volunteer or else you're going to go. You're going to go anyway. So I said, okay, I'll volunteer. And I worked nights over there with a Royal Rifle, and I'll be damned if I can remember his name, Russ. But we worked in the dysentery end of the diphtheria hospital. We were the only orderlies on duty at night. And anybody that ended up in that ward, as a rule, never got out. I mean, we became, oh, I wish I could remember his name, but we became, in a sense, hard-skinned to death of any kind because of that. You would work with a man from the time you went on at maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, with a bedpan, and then about 5 o'clock in the morning, he'd went to see how he was, and if he did, he died during the night. Not a sound, never knew it. And we were continually checking on them, but these things happened, and it was a case of just they either survived or they didn't. There was nothing we could do for them.
How rampant was the disease? Were there many people?
Diphtheria?
Yeah.
Well, not just Canadians, but I would say in that hospital, we had, for a period of a month, we must have had 4 burials a day from diphtheria deaths the day before and the night before. The padres could tell you better than I on that. They went out to Boot Hill at the Argyle, that hill I mentioned to you. There would be 4 and 5 boxes in the truck every day.
What padres would
Captain Late, he's in Vancouver now, and Captain Barnett. And one was United Church, one Barnett was the Anglican, I think. And then there was, I can't tell you the, we had an RC priest, I can't tell you his name. There was a three of them. Anyway, where were we? And in the hospital. The Japanese eventually did bring in some antitoxin, and it did. It stopped any further deaths from diphtheria. The deaths in the diphtheria hospital just weren't all from diphtheria, as I say, they were from dysentery too, but a combination of them. They were in a position they couldn't eat because of diphtheria. Because of diphtheria, and you can't live too long even without eating rice, and it was just a downhill go for them, that's all.
Were there any doctors working with you?
Yes, in the hospital, oh yes, we had, well, Captain Reed and Captain Banfield, and Captain Major Crawford. Our own doctors, and British doctors were in there too, because there was British troops and some British troops in with the crew. They weren't all Canadians.
Were there Indian troops at the
Not too many. They moved the Indian troops out. I won't say the Indian troops became turncoats, but some of the Indian troops worked for the Japanese, as similarly to some Koreans had worked for the Japanese after Japan had taken Korea over. After 1937. They were still prisoners, but they were away from camp. But I went to Japan in 1943 in August, and my brother died in October. I never knew he had died until after the war was over.
How were you chosen to go to Japan? Or were you?
Like the rest of them were. They lined all the Canadians up and marched you up and down the parade square, and they picked out the ones that they didn't want to take. I'll tell you, there was a lot of us limping, but even if you limped, you went. That's all there was to it. The doctors did take some off, and they would put some on, some that wanted to go and others didn't want to, and I couldn't get off. I wanted to stay because of Ronnie. But because he and I had always said if there was another draft to come up for Japan, we'd go together. But he ended up in Bowen Road Hospital, and I never did see him. He had a brain tumor, mastoids in his ear operation, and then he had a brain tumor, this other guy.
Did you stay close to each other when you were in Japan?
Yes, we did, after we got back together. There was 10 years difference in our age. He's 10 years older than me. And we stayed pretty close. We shared, while we were together, we shared our cigarettes and anything that was shareable, let's put it this way. And we finally got split up when Major Crawford tried, but there was just no way I had to go. So I resigned myself to that fact.
Do you remember how you left the camp?
Yeah, we... Well, can't recollect. Yeah, we marched to the dock. We marched to the dock with our kits. They didn't drive us. And the first draft that had gone, we were always told they'd gone on a hospital ship. I don't know whether they did or not. Can't recall. We thought this is what we were going on, but we ended up... It must have been an old ship that they'd raised in the Hong Kong Harbor that had been sunk and patched up. There was 250 men in each hold, back and front, and we were packed in like sardines. We left Hong Kong, I can't tell you the dates, it would be near the 1st of August, I guess. And we were 3 weeks on that ship going to Japan. We were 10 days in Formosa itself, in port, below as a whole. You might get up for a half hour each day for a breath of air, but they had air chutes up when we in port. But we were in that hole the way they were waiting for a convoy to cross to Japan. And I'll tell you, I went right down to 108 pounds again. If the man on either side of you was sleeping, there was no room for you to sleep. You had to sit up. That's how crowded it was.
For 3 weeks.
Yeah. And as I say, you got up above deck for perhaps a half hour, an hour each day. That was all. Unless you went to the camp. And all that was a boarded off plank along the side of the ship. Then we ended up, we docked in Osaka, and we had a 300-mile train trip, I guess, to Niigata. That's where we ended up.
Was this a new camp, or was there somebody
there? Yeah, new camp, completely new huts for us they built. And we were in three different camps, all told, I guess. We all went to the same camp at first, and there was a gang worked in the coal yard, and a gang in the dockyard, and a gang in the foundry. We had 50 Canadians in the dockyard, and there'd be the rest were split up between the coal yard and the foundry. And then we moved from that camp to another one. And when we moved to the other one, the foundry gang went to a separate camp. But that first camp we were in, there was the Rinko coal yard. I can't remember the Jap's name, but he was a civilian, wore a beard. And he had something to do with the coal yard itself. I don't think he owned it, but part of it. Anyway, he told us that we were descendants of Anglo-Saxon pirates, and that if we worked hard for them, when Japan won the war, they let us go home. I think some of the fellas got him when the war was over and pulled his whiskers out, whisker by whisker. That's the story anyway, whether it happened or not, I don't know. But
what kind of work did you do?
We were stevedores in the docks.
What did that involve? Get up early in the morning?
Yeah, we were up at 6 o'clock, and we'd march to work at the docks, and if we were working on pig iron, the ships would come in from China and from Manchuria and Korea, I guess, and they'd dump the pig iron on the dock, and the girls with their ox carts would bring it around to the box cars, and we'd load the box cars. If it was soybeans, if a ship came in loaded with soybeans, the bags were dumped on the dock, and we carried the bags in and stacked them in the warehouse or directly into the box cars if the box cars were there.
Did you ever get a chance to get any soybeans, DJ?
Oh, yeah. In the early part of it, we had two young Japs, Sato-san and Kabaya-san, that were of military age, but because of the work they were doing, I guess they were excused, but eventually they took them to the army. And we ended up with an old foreman, a honcho, Sibia-san. We called him Seabiscuit. But he had been in the First World War, and he wasn't like the younger ones were. He was a lot easier, honest. And he had Kabaya-san, and then eventually they took Kabaya-san too. But we had a mess shack where we went for our break at noon hour, and he put Carl Johnson and then Bob McLeod in there at one time as cooks, and we had a bag of soybeans in there all the time, and we got an extra can of soybeans at dinner time. And I think this is what helped those in the dockyards, because of that fact there's a lot of protein value in soybeans. And oh, we had puppy dogs in them once. My young daughter doesn't like that thought, but the female out in the dockyards had pups, and the fellow in the shack asked us if we wanted them, and yeah, sure. So Joe Falcon killed them and I did the butchering.
I skinned them.
Gave them to Carl, and they cooked them up. But
how were they? You hadn't had meat for quite a while. I was wondering how it.
By this time we had a fair amount of meat. We had an army warehouse we had broken into. I could tell you stories for days. But anyway, that was the soybeans we got to eat. And the odd time, we'd have a race with the young coolies loading cars of soybeans. And Sevier-san knew that, he says, his Canadians, the word he used, were number one, that we could beat them. And they would line up maybe 10 cars, 5 for them and 5 for us. And we'd work through 2 warehouse doors. They'd be working in a long line. There might be 25 of them, and you'd have 3 loading, and 1 in the car stacking, and the rest carrying. And they were all, I can't interpret it for you, but it was, two words they used was Yol Song. This was their chant. It was a song they sang. And we would break up into 2 smaller gangs and use 2 warehouse doors. And just 2 men loading, and the man carrying would help. Those bags were 80 kilos, so you know how heavy they were. And when we first started on it, well, we thought it would kill us. But we watched the younger ones, the coolies, as we call them, working. And once we got the knack of it, it was easy. You actually, I'll say you ran with them, you trotted with them. And once the bag come up and you got your hooks into it, you could. All you were doing was moving the weight. You became very accustomed and adept at it. And we'd have 4 men loading instead of 6. Mm-hmm. And that'd make an extra man carrying. And until we get down near the end of the car, we did our own stacking. And we could load 5 cars by the time they were getting into the center of their 4th car. And then we'd get an extra bag of beans, you see. And he'd bet with them. Pig iron was the same. They got so that the Japanese people or out there got so that we had to handle per man so many tons a day. If I'm not mistaken, it'd be about 18 tons. Because if you were working on pig iron, one man could take a car of pig iron and load it. Well, maybe an hour before dinner time. And then you were finished work for the day. You'd be down to the mess shack and go to sleep. But that got to be too good because there'd be by this time our gang of 50 Canadians would be down to, there might be 25 active workers, and then those that were sick, the odd time there'd be somebody coming out extra from camp, that's all. But there'd be maybe 10 of us, if the cars were available on a given day on pig iron, would line our cars up, and we'd load a car of pig iron before dinner time when we were finished for the day. But as I say, the Japs got so that, this is too much. They've got to work after they load their car, so we gave it up. We wouldn't do it. But the odd time we'd get broken up into a small gang, I remember one, there was Pete Riesdorf and Bob McLeod and Todd, I forget his first name, from the Royal Rifles of Canada, from the East. The first 2 I mentioned were Grenadiers, and Doobie. I think he's at the coast now, and myself and an old Jap we call the Shadow, and we were to load these bags from this warehouse, empty bags that were tied up in big stacks, into this boxcar, into these cars. We had to clean the warehouse out, and we found out they were formerly sugar bags, and in the corner there was always some wet sugar. Well, Doobie had dysentery bad. And mind you, we didn't take turns, but whenever the Shadow come along, he'd say, "Nanda Doobie, you see, where's Doobie?" Well, Doobie's gone to the Benjo. But Doobie was in behind the stack, opening up the bundles and taking the sugar out and tying them up again, and the rest of us loaded the car. And, I guess we did that job over a period of 2 months, not every day, but periodically they would empty these bag warehouses out. And we always had sugar, which helped. We had an army warehouse that, I don't know whether it was Joe Falcon or who, but somebody fixed the lock on the door so that we could get into it and close it up. And in there, there was powdered milk, and there was, I call it bully beef. It was a canned meat of some kind, an army ration, but there were army warehouses. And another warehouse had shoes in it, boots. We used to wear a pair of army boots, brand new army boots in, and carry our own. Even though they searched us, they never think about the boots. And we'd give the boots to a fellow in the coal yard the next day, and he'd wear them out and carry his shoes, and he'd sell the boots to the civilians for cigarettes. There was always rackets to be run. But this warehouse business had to stop because we had some English prisoners come up from a camp near Tokyo after they were burned out. They brought them up to Niigata, and these fellows had done some stevedoring down there, and they thought they knew the ropes. And they were eating the powdered milk and throwing the cans into the canal. And the Kempeitai, the secret police, found them. And, well, we just had, it was dummy from then on, and no more warehouse. I mean, it couldn't be. And that killed it. We told them. We would go in there with a loot bag and maybe get three cans of powdered milk and stash the bag down your leg, put the cans back in, close the crate up, and get out of the warehouse. But they weren't. But the Japanese never found out how. They never did discover the door as to how. It was between two warehouses. And they picked the lock, first of all, and they took the screws out of the hasp, and if you did it the right way, you could pull it out and stuff the holes when you were finished and push it back in. This is what it amounted to. And they never, when they checked the door, they used a key to open the lock. And they went in, but they never disturbed the hatch. I mean, if they had it, they'd have found it out. But this is the way we had it worked. And it was right close to our mess shack. And you were far enough away from the guards, and whenever you went in, you either did it at lunchtime, two of you would wander away, or you'd come down to go to the can at the mess shack, and you'd make your trip in then.
What was the name of this camp? The name of this
the camp? Well, it was Niigata.
Niigata.
N-I-I-G-A-T-A, and it was Camp 5B, if I remember correctly. Yeah, Camp 5B.
Did you spend the rest of the time in this camp?
Yeah. Oh, we had quite an experience there in December 31st, 1943, January 1st, 1944. One of the huts we were sleeping in lost, collapsed on us. And I had my hips smashed and three ribs broken. And I think my back was injured then too, but I can't prove that right now. But there's some damage there.
The hut collapsed.
Yeah, the camp was built on the side of a hill. And sand is loose, and it does have a tendency to move. And this, I guess, is what it was. But the beams, the top of the roof and the top of the V, they'd have a round beam about the size of the telephone pole in diameter, mm-hmm. Like a hydro pole out there. And all that was holding it up was the equivalent of 2x4s, but they were all round, maybe 4 inches in diameter. And all the upper structure was heavy log. They don't use nails. They use wooden pegs. They're good, great carpenters. They cut their slots or their square holes and square the 4x4 off and drop it in, and then another hole would go through them with a wooden peg. No nails, nothing. Anyway, this hut collapsed. By this time, we had Americans with us. They were on one side, and the hut fell from their side over our way. And we were sleeping on the upper deck, and Doobie and I, at that time, we had only had two blankets, and this was in, the weather was cold, and we were sleeping together, and we'd been sleeping with our heads to the aisle, and that night we changed our minds and slept with our heads to the wall. The air was a little cooler, fresher up there, and it hit us on the hips. Doobie had his hips smashed. It was four of us.
You broke the bone?
Oh, yeah. Never said. Jerry Mabley, Joe Gursky, Tex Hicks, an American, Doobie and myself, five of us, were all injured, all the same. And bones were never, they never knew they were broken. They x-rayed us, but I think all of us were the same way. We were sore down between the legs from the crunch. And Mabley and Hicks, I think, were put in casts. But Gursky and what's his name and I were just, Mabley and I. Mabley was never put in a cast. But Hicks and Mabley were put in cast. Gursky and myself and Doobie weren't. There must have been eight of them killed by that. And they were all sleeping with their heads. They had their beam hit them and crushed their chest. And they had to cut that to get us out. And then they had to set up a special little hospital for us. And at that time, the Japanese brought a Major Kagi, an American doctor, up from the Shinagawa Hospital in Tokyo, I guess, to the camp to see. We had a doctor there, an English doctor, but he was a medical man, straight pill roller, I guess you'd call him. They brought Kagi up. He was a surgeon. And he knew bloody well something was wrong, but they couldn't figure out what. And I lay on my back the rest of them were the same, not just myself, in a special hut from January till, it would be into, there's still some snow on the ground, it would be into the first part of April, with my knees propped up, flat on my back, and padding under here for my leg. As I say, we're all the same. But when I stood up, I couldn't get my back straight from laying so long, first of all. My legs were weak. I finally got a little strength back in them. But I'd walk with a stick and go down the hall, and I had to hang onto the wall.
That's it. This is track 3.
Yeah. There was one other injured. I said Doobie. Doobie wasn't. It was Ray Fiddler from Stonewall was the other one. We were all the same way in that little special part of that camp in that hut for that length of time. And finally, we did get up and move around, and we did go back out to work in the dockyard, back to our own camps and back out to work at the docks. And I developed a sore spot on my right rear cheek, and it started to swell up. And I went on sick parade, and they, Major Stewart was the English doctor. Keggy had gone by this time. And Stewart told me then that he felt that that had been something. There was a broken bone in there, and this was an abscess that was formed. And that thing got... Well, they must have taken about 2 quarts of pus out of it when they did cut into it in the end. But it just throbbed continually for a week, and I lay on my stomach. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't lay on my back at all. And finally, he and the American pharmacist mate we had come in and lanced it. They cut it open, and it started to drain right away. But he had to use a probe and get in to break the different pockets. It was all in different spots. And oh,
like
what a relief!
Boil?
Just like a boil, only it was an abscess inside. And they used a cotton gauze that I guess had been soaked in yellow sulfathiazole, and to keep it open. And they'd come every morning and pull this filling out and get in with their little long probe again. And finally, I guess it drained it all out. And it healed up, and Fiddler in the meantime was in with something, and he and I ended up with a great job there for about a month and a half. We were battling to the great job from point of food. It was, we were sort of battling to the Japanese. We cleaned up their office and their quarters and brought their food over in the morning and at dinner and at supper. And we never drew any of our own rations in that time. I gave mine to Sosan, and Ray gave his to Jerry Mabley. They were both out working in the docks. And we always got enough. Well, we didn't eat anything in our own hut. By the time we finished them in Japanese quarters, we were full. And it did, something else, as I say, always comes along to help, and to me this is another thing that helped me survive and come home. And finally Major Stewart called us in one day, and he said, I think it's time you fellows went back out and let somebody else in there. And we were quite willing to. And but we got pickles, we got little bits of meat, extra rice. Mind you, we didn't keep it all ourselves, but as I say, Sosan and with me, and Jerry Mabley with Fiddler were our bunk mates. We were side by side, and if we got anything extra, we shared it with them. This is what it amounted to. And then we went back out to work and worked until the war was over in 1945.
Were you getting any news from the outside? Did you know what was happening? Whether the Japanese were winning or losing?
To go back to Hong Kong, there was a Dutch submarine crew come in there early in 42, January 42, I guess. And whether they brought it all with them or not, I don't know, but they did have a radio. And the Japanese eventually did find it, and they beat them up and confiscated the radio, but we did get some news through that. I think what they did was brought in the component parts and scrounged the rest around camp and built a radio. And there'd be a number of them in camp at that time. The Japanese eventually got them all. While in Japan, it was a little more difficult. We had no out-and-out technicians in our end of the Grenadiers that could do it, or in the American end of it. But in 1945, in April, I guess, of 45, the Japanese brought over from Shanghai a number of civilians that had been taken prisoner on Wake Island in Guam, that had were technicians working there when the war broke out, and they picked up arms and they eventually interned them and moved them to Shanghai. And when they came into our camp, ingeniously I call it, they brought in radio parts in Red Cross boxes. Klim powdered milk, it's not on the market now, but at that time was quite a seller. And it would be about the size of a half-pound tobacco can. And they ingeniously took the bottom off and would stash the key parts in the powdered milk and then put the bottom back on and the seal on the can hadn't been broken, so the Japs had no reason to suspect there was anything inside. And they brought all their parts in that way, and with what they could scrounge out at work and in camp, they built a receiver. And we had up to the minute news then. We knew how well things were going, but the Japanese never did find the radio in Japan, but like they knew we were getting the news from someplace, they just couldn't figure it out. The other way, out in the docks and in Tokyo, there was a paper printed, the Nippon Times, and it was printed in English. Why, I never have found out. Maybe because of English-speaking non-belligerents or countries that weren't at war with Japan. When Japanese people traveled, they have no suitcases, most of them. They wrap their belongings up in a straw mat. The bundle might be 4 feet in diameter and about 5 feet in length. And we always, as I say, we always strafed it when it was unloaded. And it would be in a warehouse, and if you got your arm in far enough, you could always find something. And periodically, we'd find a Japanese Nippon Times. And you would read where the Japanese had, they never called it defeat, but the one in particular that sticks in my mind is their defeat on Okinawa. When they pulled out of Okinawa, and as they said, it was a strategic withdrawal, to use a British term, they moved back to the home islands to defend them. This was it. And we knew from the activity in Niigata itself that there was something coming. It was a good harbor spot, and their ships, transports would come in and unload. They unloaded anti-aircraft guns, and the railway would haul them away, and this is what it was. And the defenses were being built in that area for against assault. And we damn well knew that this is what it was going to come to.
Were you able to go outside the camp in Shamshupo? You were able to? No, North Point.
North Point.
You were able to go outside the camp. In
through that storm sewer.
Yeah. In Japan, were you able to go outside?
No.
Were the armed
guards? No, it was senseless in this sense. First of all, because the Japanese people weren't. The civilians showed actually no animosity towards us, but again, they weren't friendly towards us. It would be senseless to attempt to do anything that way, particularly there if you were caught. You might have the civilian population to contend with, too. No, we could. We had a number of means of trading, as I mentioned, new army boots. The few Red Cross parcels we did get in Japan, the American parcel, had either 8 or 10 packs of American cigarettes in it. And in my case, I guess I was a little mercenary, we got 2.5 American parcels in Japan. And I traded everything off for cigarettes. In other words, I could sell my powdered milk can for maybe 5 or 6 packs of cigarettes, and I would gather the cigarettes in and hide them. I had a friend in the hospital that looked after my loot for me safely, and then when cigarettes got scarce, I could buy the canned milk back for 1 pack of cigarettes. It was, in a sense, it was survival of the fittest. You had to look out for yourself, nobody else would. And this was the reason. I could trade a pack of American cigarettes off of work with the Japs for maybe 5 or 6 packs of Japanese cigarettes. And mind you, eventually you'd run out, but the cigarette or cigarettes were a medium of exchange. And we had one guard, well, I didn't bribe him, but Joe Squirk did from Gotham. Joe got caught with 2 pant legs full of rice, and stealing rice was taboo. And it was Holy Joe, a young
civilian back and forth to camp. And his name, Holy Joe, comes from the fact he had a hole behind his ear. Right in.
In his head?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the bone, I guess it had been in operation at some time and it never healed properly. I mean, all you saw was skin inside, but it was a hole. And that's where his name came from. Anyway, he was at the back of the column on our march back to camp, and he spotted this race. And with his eagle eye, he just followed it up to the front, and here's my head to be Joe, and he stopped. And he never said anything to the guards, but he felt Joe's legs, and he knew right away it was Joe. And Mac Hawes, he died after. Mac was our macho, our sergeant then, in charge of the Canadians. And he had a fair, he had a better speaking ability in Japanese than the rest of us. Anyway, we bribed Holy Joe with American cigars. And from then on, we had him by the short hair. because if the fact had become known, he'd have really got ill. Anyway, it must have cost Joe about 25 packs of cigarettes to buy him off. And the rice. Joe got the rice. Not Squirt, Holy Joe. He made sure of that. But that was quite the way of getting loot in the camp, soybeans in particular. We wore two pair of pants, and you tie the pair inside tight at the ankle, and then pull your socks over them, and the outside pair would cover them, and you could fill almost up to the crotch with soybeans. And we usually knew if we were going to be searched or not. We had he'd been a soldier, he'd sick TB or something. And he was bound, he was going to learn to speak English. And at noon hour, we would talk to him in English and he'd talk to us in Japanese. And this is the way we were developing it. And he would always tell us at, in the afternoon that it was dummy to steal him because we'd be searched going back in that night. And we usually got away with it. The odd time we get caught. And
What happened?
I can give you a personal experience. Taffy Richards, he was in either the Middlesex or Royal Scots. It was in, would be in June of 1945, not much longer before we were liberated. He and I took some soybeans in one night. And as I say, we didn't expect a search. Satasan hadn't said anything, hadn't told us that one way or the other. But the Japanese Sergeant Major, Pistol Pete, as we call him, had come back from Tokyo and had brought a friend back with him. And we had just had the beans in our haversack, just a small bag of them. And we didn't, with Pistol Pete away, he was the only one that ever searched us. And hell, we get in the gate and they give us a halt and we stopped and out he come and he's got his friend with him. Going to show him how he handles his prisoners of war. So we opened up ranks and they started to search. And I had my haversack pushed around behind me and hid. And I had everything else out, you see. And the guard that searched me missed the haversack. But the Taffy Richards was standing behind me and the guard caught his beans. And when he turned around, he hit my haversack and there's the beans. So that was it. And they dismissed the rest of them, and Pistol Pete stood us in front of the guardhouse at attention, and he called us everything under the sun in Japanese. He painted our faces with thief and steel on it, in Japanese character, and then he went to work on us. And as he went to work on Richards first. But I tell you, it's difficult to stand there and let a man punch you in the face without striking back, but this is something that you had to do. Luckily enough for me, he spent most of his power on Richards, and what I got were lesser blows, I guess. And then they stood us in front of the guardhouse, and we stood there all night at attention, and went out to work the next morning. The only break we got, about every half hour, we'd call the guard, one or the other of us, we had to go to the Benjo. And away we'd go. And you'd run, the guard would run with you, and you'd run back and stand. But it was the only way we could keep circulation going. We got out to work the next day, and when old Sebius-san found out what had happened, he told us to go over to the mess shack and hide and go to sleep. He laughed. But it was no laughing matter, I'll tell you. One other case, a young Middlesex fellow, can't recall his name, but he had come up in the early spring from Tokyo with the rest of the Englishmen. Decided one day that he wasn't going to work anymore. And the guards beat him up out of work, rifle butts and kicks. And we get back into camp, and the camp commandant we had at that time was a dyed-in-the-wool Cymry officer, I guess you'd call him. And he used his sword scabbard on. And Jack Parker, Captain Parker, an American officer, went out to, I guess, stop it, and he went after Parker the same way. And they put the boots to the kid and everything else. Now, the kid never went back out to work. I say kid because he was shorter than me. But he never did end up back out at work. He was spent his time in hospital. His eyesight had been damaged from the blows and kicking. And I guess a large part of the rest of them was. But the camp commandant disappeared. They eventually did get him, and I think he stood war trial, war crimes. But Major Fellows, I think the American major in charge of the camp, is the one that got the information on him and turned him in.
How did the Americans and Canadians get along?
Very well. You can have a look in that little book there with my picture on the front. We got along very well together. We were in Japan about 4 months before they brought them there. They arrived there. We got there in August, and I guess they come in. They come into our camp in late November or early December, and there was 100 of them. And we got on well with them. They all worked in the dockyards. None of them worked in the coal yard at all. They were all in the dockyards. But they had about 4 months less of being a prisoner of war confinement than we'd had. And in while they had suffered in the Philippines, I think they had more access to better nourishment, more food than we had, and they were in better shape physically. And this is the reason they all went out to the docks. And the dockyard gang were all in the same hut. We got on well with them, very well. Working with them and everything else. And if there came a case of a strafing job, if there was something to steal. Well, at one time, we were all the same. They were too, I guess. It was first come, first served. But we found out that if there was some loot to get into camp, or we were able to steal something to benefit, if there was 10 in the gang, the 10 guys shared it. I mean, this is what they had to amount to that. Otherwise, you'd never have got away with it. And we all worked well together with them. And those parts you can look back on and laugh, the way we fooled the Japs. But we had one, I told you, Custer, one of the best thieves in the Niigata. When they searched Custer, they stripped him down. He took all his clothes off because he was, they knew, if the rest of us had nothing on us, Custer would have something on him. And he was quite a Dutchman. It was quite the camp. We had a lot of fun in some things, and as I say, when we relate anything like that, we can laugh at the funny parts, the way we used to fool them, the way you could put things over on them. But not always. I would say this, that the civilians that we worked with knew what we were doing. Particularly, I mentioned one earlier, the Shadow. You're too young to remember the magazine, but there was a magazine on the market when I was a kid called The Shadow, and his name was Mark Cranston. Not the fellow who wrote the book, there's The Shadow. And his makeup was a black hat and a black cape, all black clothes. And this Japanese was tall and slim and wore a black hat and a black, all black uniform and black cape. And we gave him the name of The Shadow.
And he couldn't speak English too well, but he could understand it. We found this out later, because if somebody was in stealing something and the shadow was coming along, we would call on the warehouse door, the shadow knows, or the shadow's coming. And he told us one day what we were doing in Japanese and English mixed. And he told us that we call him the shadow, he knows, and he knows why. There was another one, we called him Uncle Henry. Remember Henry Morgan, the actor? Oh, that's before your time, too. Henry Morgan? Uncle Henry? That's where his name came from, anyway. Frank Morgan was the actor, that's it. That's it. But we call this guy Uncle Henry, because he was, he just looked like Frank Morgan, the actor. Short, fat, and jolly. And he was the type, if you had the shadow and Uncle Henry on the stage, the shadow would be the straight man and Uncle Henry would be the comedian. This is just the way the two of them were. And I remember one day, I guess it was Ike Friesen and Pete Griesdorf had a piece of chalk, and we'd been pushing boxcars to line up for this warehouse, and it was a black boxcar. Anyway, they took this piece of chalk and they had drawn some, just like a map on it, and the secret police, the Kempeitai, they brought the car back into the docks, and they found out the shadow had seen Doobie and Griesdorf and Friesen doing this, you see. And they brought the car back in and they got them there. They want to know what the map was of. And it was just a practical joke, but it caused quite a problem at the time. They would call them the Boshy girls. Oh, I better not put this on tape. The ox carts that hauled the pig iron. They were all sizes and shapes, but one would be short and fat, and the other was skinny and well shaped, thin but well shaped. And Carl Johnson is dead now. He died here a couple of years ago. But Carl, we'd been loading newsprint one day, and Carl was working in the car, and the block below the roll had slipped, and he had his leg pinned between the roll and the door, steel door, and it injured his knee badly, and he couldn't work anymore. He always had a sort of a limp after that. So they put him in our kitchen as cook, and out of work, he was our mess shack cook. And before that, though, when we were working on soybeans, Japanese I won't say sadistic, but they're, what's the word I'm looking for? Carl was well endowed, I'll put it this way. And Sibia-san knew, and this little Japanese girl, this short, fat one that ran this ox cart, we always got a 10-minute break in the morning for a cigarette, for a smoke. And Sibia-san was telling them that Canada, Johan Olsen was Ochi, he was big. And I guess women were saying all over, I mean, giving him a hard time. And Sibia-san told Carl to chase her, and he did. But nothing happened. But oh, she sure screamed. She wouldn't believe it. There was another, I call it a funny instance. The other, Bob, I mentioned earlier, Bob McLeod and Mac Hawes dying. In June of 1945, we were loading 45-gallon drums onto a barge, onto a puni, and one of the drums accidentally happened to tip over on the cement dock, and it cracked the top, and we could smell the alcohol. And, I guess like everything else, we had to find out what it was. It was alcohol, and somebody was going to bound, they were going to have a drink. And we had a small coffee can, 3-ounce coffee can, we used for a standard measure. And everybody carried one. Anyway, the Mac Hawes, Bob McLeod, Jim Kirk, and Jim Guard, and Squark, and myself, and Pete Riesdorf, and Doobie, we were the ones that had drinks. And it was alcohol, but it had a glycerine in it. And glycerine, to me, is still sickly sweet. And I had one drink, and that was enough. And Squark, and Riesdorf, and Doobie, I guess, were the same. But the other four had more than they should have. When we had the early break, we get back to the mess shack, and we still had some soybeans left from dinner, and the rest of us ate them. But we practically carried Roy Kirk back into camp. They never did. They went into a coma. They were just raving. It had potassium chromate in it, and it went after the lining of the stomach. And when the Japanese found out what it was, they got stomach pumps in and everything else, but it was too late. We had to tell Major Stewart what it was. And they went after us, they pumped our stomachs too. But we had got back to camp that night and had powdered milk. And the little bit of eating we'd done out of work, I think, is what helped us. Because I haven't seen Squark for about 4 years, but Doobie and Riesdorf and myself, our stomachs, we never had any stomach trouble that way. And Squark hasn't. So it did help. But they died, and it was just, you might say, a month and a half before we were liberated. And it was too bad. But that's what happened. That's life. Bob McLeod was one of them. I said 5, 6 of them. Bob McLeod died, too.
There were 6 of you that got into the alcohol.
No, there was more than that. There was Mac Hawes, Roy Kirk, Jimmy Guard, Bob McLeod died, 4. And there was Squark and Riesdorf and Doobie and myself. There was 8 of us all together. We're working in the gang. And but we were, I won't say we were in eating a lot that time, but the smell of alcohol, I guess we had to, just to see what it was, and this is it. If it was worthwhile, it might have been worthwhile taking some back into camp. This is what we were looking at. It never did develop, and their parents here, when we come back, never knew this. Until we got back, they knew they even died. Communications weren't.
Did you receive any letters or parcels from home?
Yes, we got no parcels. I got the parcel my mother sent me, I got after I came home. Come back. I guess all told, Ross, I got about 2-3 postcards and about 4 letters. And we wrote, I guess all told, over there, we wrote about 4 or 5 times, and I think it was only twice my mother got anything. And once it was a broadcast from Tokyo that a ham operator on the American West Coast, somewhere in Washington, had picked up a broadcast from Japan, purportedly a recording from me. But it was one of my letters home that somebody, the Japanese, had taken to Tokyo and had got somebody else to read as supposedly being me. And this was after we had been injured when this building collapsed. The Japanese had told the Red Cross it had been a typhoon that had blown the building down.
What had?
No, nothing.
Storm or
building anything? Just no, building just collapsed. But I'll tell you, we did have there was a typhoon in the area later. This would be in 1944, we had winds in that camp, and I wouldn't stay in the hut. I'd get out between the fence and the hospital hut. I get in there. I wasn't going to stay in any building. No. You never know. Anyway, I had that fear. But the night that building collapsed, to come back to that, the night that building collapsed, I had a dream. I guess when the wood started crumbling and crunching, this is what hit me. I was on a stack of apples out in this warehouse, and the stack had collapsed. And the crunching of the lumber I heard was saying apple boxes collapsed. We did well on fruit in Japan too, in season. The late fall, there was Ringo's. It's a cross between a pear and an apple, and the Japanese name for it is Ringo. It's like a delicious apple and a pear, the flavor. And it has a yellowish brown skin, but it's rough. And then there was apples, and there was Japanese oranges that you see in the Safeway today, still tied up the same way in boxes of three, tied together with straw rope. And those would come in boxcar loads. Whole train loads would pull in. And we'd unload them out of the boxcar, stack them in the warehouse, and then they'd go out on a barge to go to the one of the other islands. And the fellows stacking would always get a box open. And as you brought your pile up, you got an apple or an orange or whatever it was to eat. But you had to eat all of it. You ate the peel and everything else, the core and an apple, because we couldn't leave evidence around. And we always used to say the Japanese didn't care what was in the boxes. If there was 100 boxes come out of a car to go out, there had to be 100 boxes there. Whether they were empty or not didn't matter. They packed their apples in sawdust. And the boxes would be about the same size as our apple box, our Macintosh apple box. And we got our fill of fruit then, but you'd only get that once a year. But we sure did a job. I remember Mac Paws when he told us to eat everything. I got a bang in the face that I always said then I'd never forgive him for, but I have since. Just to show you, we had so many apples to eat. I ate this one, and the core, I wasn't going to eat it. I threw it over towards the wall of the warehouse, and I'll bet Mac was off that stack in about four jumps, and bang. And he said, "You're not going to get any more till this afternoon." No, and I don't blame. I mean, it had to be. Rules are rules. And but that... I'd say that we'd work all year just to wait for that time.
The apple.
Until the apples, or the fruit time. What else? Well...
Do you remember when the war was over? How did you know that the war had ended?
Well, I was going to ask you, or if you want to know. For the week previous out at work, we found out the war was over on the 16th of August, and the first atomic bomb was dropped sometime around the 1st of August, the 2nd or 3rd. And from that time on, we knew something had happened. Our work pattern out at work had changed. They had us digging air raid shelters, and among other things. And they would never tell us what it was for, but the Japanese themselves were always away talking secretly in little groups, because they knew we could understand Japanese. In some senses we could speak it too. A mixture of English and Japanese, a pidgin language, but we always knew what they were talking about. And this is what it was. I guess they were talking about the atomic bomb, and then when the next one was dropped, I guess 2 days later, this sort of put the clincher on it. Anyway, the 14th of August, I think, 1945. We'd gone out to work in the morning, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a guard came out from camp on a bicycle and told us that we were going back to camp to rest, because the next day we were going to carry in wood, timber, for the winter, firewood for the winter, that the sick fellows in camp had been cutting on the hill outside camp. And we went back in and we had supper. There wasn't any, no rush of Japs around the camp the way they normally was. Anyway, out we go the next morning to carry in the wood, and the guards were saying, Shinshu-Awari, war's over, Shinshu and Japanese is war. And we would laugh at them and said, yeah, when it's over, the Allies are going to win too. And they'd say, yeah, fighting, you know, shooting stopped, war over. But they told us no peace had been signed, but the war had stopped, fighting had stopped. Well, we had an English interpreter, Englishman interpreter, Rance, in camp, and the story got to him. And he and Major Fellows went over to Camp Common and asked him, and he told them that the fighting had stopped. This is what he brought us in for. This wooden deal was just a come on. They wanted to get us into camp when we found out, because they were afraid of what might happen. Anyway, he told them the fighting had stopped and that was it. Well, Major Fellows told him, he says, well, that's it for you too. He says, you go into the guardhouse. He took over the guards, they took their ammunition away. They left them their rifles, took their bayonets and ammunition. But they left the guards on the gate because they felt that there was going to be any repercussions from the civilians, that the guards there would sort of be a deterrent. But inside of 3 days, there must have been, I can't remember the hotel, but there must have been, oh, in 5 days, there must have been 15 or 20 of us living in a hotel downtown. We used what money we had. Len Mulvaney and I must have had about, from base and playing poker on the odd day we had a rest, I must have accumulated about 1,000 yen. And money, we found out when we get down there, money, you could get more for a pack of cigarettes than you could for 1,000 yen. But we used up everything we had. In the meantime, they had dropped us supplies, food, new clothes, blankets.
Had any of the area in Japan around where you, around where the camp was, been bombed?
No, all they did, they mined the harbor with acoustic mines. And they did a damn good job. But the B-29s would come over every night. And they followed the same pattern. They only hit one, though. They only shot one down in that time. And they dropped mines in the harbor. And they had the harbor filled up. The barges had to go out, the ships, and load them and unload them. They couldn't, the ships couldn't come in the dock. They had so many sunk out there. And Niigata was almost in the center of Japan, on the Sea of Japan. In other words, the island of Honshu, the biggest island. They had to bring that stuff in through Niigata to get it through to the rest of Japan. This is the way they did it. The Americans really did a job on that harbor.
Do you remember the planes flying over dropping supplies?
Oh yeah, do I ever. I'd have to say it was August the 16th that the first fighters off the aircraft carrier spotted. I guess their job was to go and find camps. Anyway, they dive-bombed the camp. And they spotted us, and the same planes went back to their carrier, but other planes come out loaded with, they had their hammocks, they'd taken their hammocks, and just loaded them down with cigarettes and anything they could clean out of their commissary. And they just come down on camp and drop them. They went through the roofs of the huts and everything else. And that was the start of it. And we got messages from them then telling us that on, I forget the date, the 18th, I guess, of August, the B-29s, when we'd never seen B-29s that low before, we'd seen them away up, all you could see were the contrails. But they told us they would be over to drop medical supplies, food, clothing, everything we needed. And it itemized it all. And it even had diet sheets as to how this stuff was to be used. And they had this prepared for a long time. It was in Japanese and Dutch, English, French, everything. And this is the way, this was their pattern. And then they started coming over and their bomb bay doors were open. Oh, God. we'd never seen a plane much bigger than a fighter before, that, any of us. And they come down, they wouldn't be too far over the huts. But they were 45-gallon drums, three of them, as a rule, welded together, and they had wooden plugs in the end, and they dropped them on parachutes.
These would be end-to-end?
Huh? Yeah, welded end-to-end, this way. And they dropped them on parachute. And some of them came into camp, some of them broke through the huts, some of the chutes didn't open. And they would spread them all, some of them were spread over the hill behind the camp. And we were out gathering all this stuff up, and I remember Ray Sosan and I. I got his picture in there. He and I sat, this had been just one drum, but the chute hadn't opened, and it had gone in, there was only about that much of it showing up, and it had canned milk in it. I forget the brand, but like carnation milk. And we got it opened up, and there was one case that had broken. And we sat there, and we drank 24 cans of evaporated milk, condensed milk, or evaporated milk. And in the meantime, everybody else did the same way. And we got all this stuff back into camp, and then they come over again the next day and dropped the rest of it. But we were all outfitted with new clothes, new uniforms. We had ample to eat. When we left, there must have been enough supplies in that camp to feed somebody for 6 months. Anyway, but as I say, we ended up downtown in the hotel. We were going out. We had communal baths, and they weren't geisha girls. Geisha girls are a little more refined, but they would come right in. They'd feed you right in bed, get in the bathtub with you, and bath you. And there might be 10 of you in the bathtub. And we'd run out of medium of exchange, and two of us would take off for camp and go back for more cigarettes. But we, earlier before that, when the fighter planes, the carrier planes had come in, we had a young civilian we'd worked with out of work. Can't remember his name. But we traded his family. His family had a farm, I'd have to say north of the camp. And Ike Elliott and I guess, an American civilian, we went out to find him. We knew, we used to see him go by the camp on his bike, and he told us out of work where he lived. And we went out, and his dad was away in the army. They didn't know he'd been away for 2.5 years. They never had word from him. Anyway, we took them blankets, new blankets. And before we left last time, they gave us an old ox, an old steer, I guess. And we took it back to camp. But he wanted a letter from us to the American or to the Allied authorities, telling them that this stuff he hadn't stolen, that he had been given it in exchange for this animal. And we took it back to camp, and it was butchered and put into the stew. But in 2 days, we had all the other supplies. But I'll tell you, no, it was something. Well, they, I guess the 1st of September, the end of August, who was it once? Pistol Pete and Rance and Captain Parker, I think, went on a train to Tokyo. And they come back with Harold Stassen. Remember Harold Stassen? Well, he used to be I guess he was governor of Minnesota. He was in charge of the liberation of all, or what was the word they used? Not liberation. The repatriation of all prisoners of war in the Far East, and as far as the Americans were concerned. And they flew over the camp in a plane and landed at the airport and were in, and they made arrangements for two trains to take us to Tokyo. And we left on the 1st of September. Geez, that's a long time ago. We left on the 1st of September and arrived in Tokyo on the 2nd. And we We'd never seen Tokyo or Yokohama before, but we saw it in its worst state. It'd been all firebombed. And the only thing that would be standing would be brick and cement buildings, masonry buildings. Anything that had wood in it at all was just gutted, burned out. And the people were living, you've seen a hobo jungle, corrugated sheet metal huts. This is what they were living in. And the whole expanse, Tokyo and Yokohama, are just feet apart. They're side-by-side cities, you might say. And they have an electric railway that connects the two of them. And both cities were the same way. And we stopped first in the station in Yokohama, and that's where we saw our first white woman, an American nurse, met us on the train. Oh, geez. Anyway, they took us to the harbor, and they deloused us and gave us new clothes again. Anybody that needed medical treatment for boils or anything else, a lot of boils developed as soon as we started. Well, we had 2 weeks of living on food that we hadn't had for almost 5 years.
And what brought out boils?
Anyway, they deloused us, and they moved us onto an LSV, a landing ship vehicle is the name. And I have his name in there. He cleaned my boils out for me, Henry Dyer from Tacoma, somewhere in the States. He was a pharmacist mate. And we spent the night on there, and the next morning, there. Buzzer goes and they hear this, and they called out about 40 American names, alphabetical, and then they started with Canadian names, alphabetical, A, Atkinson, and so on down through to the C's, 10 of us. And right away I said, here it is, yeah, here comes a job, we're going to clean the ship up. And all they said was, pack your kit, you're leaving for the airport. And we went to Tokyo to the Azuchi airstrip and got on a C-47 or C-54 Navy transport plane and flew to. We stopped in Saipan, I guess, for supper. And at supper time, had supper, and we took off and we flew to Guam. And we were in Guam. The night of the 3rd, all day on the 4th, and the night of the 4th, and the morning of the 5th, we took off for Hawaii.
Had you seen any other Canadians or heard anything about them? You said they were...
No, Canada. They're Canadians from...
Shemship World?
Oh, no, they were...
Those, or any of the other camps in Japan?
No, we were just our own camp, Camp 5B. We did, no, I shouldn't say that, there was some from Tokyo too, because we ran across, when I found out my brother died, one of our old cooks, Woodhead, Sergeant Woodhead, had left Hong Kong after I had, and I asked him where Ronnie was, and he says, hell, he says, didn't you know, he says, he died in 1943, and it shook me. As I say, we've seen so much death that never bothered me. And we got to Guam, and I sent a wire to my mother telling her that where I was, as I'm flying home. And I got a wire back asking where Lonnie was. I knew that they didn't know. They didn't know, like at home. My sister-in-law got a call on a Sunday night, the 16th, from the telegraph office, a wire from Ottawa. They were getting ready to come down to the train at Eaton, telling her that Ronnie had died in 1942, and she was expecting him. And that's when that hit me hard, was when they met me at the station. My little niece had never seen her. And I still have her picture. Ronnie got a picture of her in 1942. And she'd be, well, she was born. He'd never seen her. Dolly went in the hospital 2 days after we left to go to Vancouver. He'd never seen her before, except for the picture. And that's when it, up until then, as I say, his death, well, it had meant something to me. I shouldn't say it hadn't meant anything to me. It meant something to me, but it didn't hit me until then. And all of you.
You were right in there?
Shocked. But there was 50 of us on the plane, 40 Americans and 10 Canadians. We had quite a time coming home. We spent 3 days and 2 nights in Hawaii, and they took us to Pearl Harbor and showed us everything. Mind you, we were at hostel all the time. And we had guided tours. We got to Oakland, California. We'd hit a point, we didn't know until the next morning. There was only 3 motors on the plane, flying, working, and daylight on the morning coming into Oakland. And the captain come back after and told us, we asked him about the motors. I mean, who knew? He said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. But he says, we hit a point of no return. He says, we were as far from Hawaii as we were from Oakland, and there was no sense in going back. And they just let the flew on the tree. Well, we landed there, and we were in, we were there, and I got home on the 16th of September. So we must have been there 2 days and 2 nights, or 2 days, 3 days and 2 nights, and we left on the train to Vancouver the next night, and got on the train the same day and come back to Winnipeg.
Were you some of the, were you about the first to get back to
I was first. No, there was 10 of us, but the rest were all went to the east. Their homes weren't here. I was the only one to stay in Winnipeg.
And you right back on what day? 16th
of September.
16th of September.
I was home, let's see, there was 3 or 4 small groups that flew home after. I can't recall all the names, but I was home, and it was a week before anybody else came. And I was, I can still remember going through the crowd at the station there. Well, figure it out, Ross. I weighed, I put on in that time, from the time we were liberated to then till I got home, was almost a month. And I bet I put on almost 30 pounds. Well, figure it out. I tell you, one of them was Ed Arsenault, a grenadier, but his home was in New Brunswick. In Hawaii, they had a sign up in the mess hall, eat all you want, but eat all you take. In other words, don't take more than you can eat. Go back 5 times if you want. Well, you know, ice cream's packed in round paper containers, gallon containers. There was a vanilla and a fruit there, and he and I polished off almost 2 gallons of ice cream one meal. And all we did was eat and sleep. And I must have weighed about 155 pounds when I come home. And I can still hear the people, their remarks. You know, the story was, the first reason they were flying me home was because I was on my last leg. And it was a shock to everybody. Well, then, I got phone calls then all that next week about this fellow and that fellow, and if I knew how he was. And I always remember Bruce Geiselman's mother phoned me. He worked in the foundry. And the last time...
They
expected to see a cripple coming home. But anyway, Harry Geiselman's mother called. The last time I'd seen him, he was dragging his legs. He was on two crutches. And I didn't know what shape he'd be in. But I told her not to expect him perhaps to look the same as me. But I couldn't very well tell her that he was on crutches. And he walked off the train. No, the same way with him. His problem was a lack of, like all of us, lack of vitamins, but it hit him in the legs. He'd lost the power of his legs. But just that space of time, from the time they got out of camp until we got home, he gained that ability to use them back. And I haven't seen him. I haven't seen him for 20 years.
It must have been a mental shock for you to be liberated and the next month to be back home with one leg.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you might say 2 weeks from the time we got out of camp. Well, I wandered around a little lost for a month. I wouldn't wear my uniform. I went and bought myself a suit and civilian clothes because, I'd met my wife then in the meantime because of her brother. And I was afraid to wear my uniform because of people in general.
Yeah.
More than anything else. But
were you sick physically when you got home? Were you still ill?
No. I played intermediate football in the fall of 1945 and 46, and 46 and 47 for the Elmwood Bombers. But I weighed 225 pounds in November of 1945. And it wasn't all on my gut. I was fat all over. When I smiled, my eyes closed. And it wasn't very, very. It was just good, plain, unadulterated fat. But I developed a little slight sugar condition in 1947 that I had to take the weight off. But I went down to 170 pounds, and I haven't varied too much since then. I'm still about that 175 today. But, no, I haven't had too much sickness from a point of stomach or, let's say, mind. Basically, it's physical, and it's a case of premature aging, I guess. I've got hardening of the arteries and a high cholesterol problem. And it's slowing me up. But I still love to play golf and I curl. I've had to curtail my ability to drink because of cholesterol. But that's been no problem. I guess at times I get a little ranty with the kids and with Penny. But it's a case of aging more than anything else. That's about it.
Can I ask how you feel about the treatment by the government since you returned here? As far as pensions or,
the treatment of the government, if it had been left up to the government, I don't think we'd have got anything. And I mean that sincerely. It's been the work of about 6 or 7 individuals in our Hong Kong Veterans Association and members of Parliament that have taken an interest and have forced some of these things through. I would say that if we had stayed dogo and hadn't stood up and yelled, that pension-wise, we wouldn't have what we have today. And again, I have to give the credit for that to those few individuals that have spent almost the last 25 years working for me. I mean that. the Veterans Affairs ministers we've had over the years have had this forced on them more than they have done it of their own free will, public opinion and opposition, and they finally did have to take the bull by the horns, the government, and find some of these things out for themselves. And when they found out the difference between, you might say, we as Hong Kong prisoners of war from Europe, like soldiers from Europe, our conditions are, our physical conditions, our health conditions are two or threefold worse than the others. Now, whether that, to me, that stems from a number of things. One, the length of time we did suffer from vitamin deficiency, that regardless of how we want to look at it as individuals, it had an effect on us to some degree mentally. It has to, because some of us may have overcome and may be able to hide some of those things now, but I think that basically we all have that difficulty. And physically, likewise, it goes back to vitamin deficiency. The whole thing goes back to vitamin deficiency more than anything else, and the length of time we were confined. Because you can take fellows that were airmen that were taken prisoner in Germany, shot down in Europe in the early war years, 1940 and 41, that are as healthy today as they as anybody else. But to compare the two, the length of time, there's no comparison. And the government, their research has proved this. But we thank the government for what they've done. They didn't have to do it, I mean. But I know damn well they wouldn't have done it if they hadn't had the pressure put on them. None of those governments would have, regardless of what they want to say. But I can't blame, to go back to going over there, when we enlisted, joined up, we didn't necessarily join up to fight the Germans or fight in Europe. We joined up because Canada needed an army, and we volunteered to go where we were asked to go, that's all. And by the luck of the cards or the roll of the dice or fate or whatever you want to call it, we ended up in China instead of in Europe, that's all. We can't blame that on the government. We can blame them in a sense for not looking maybe into it further. They may not have had time, but looking into it further and sending troops there that were, in a broad sense, had more training than we did. I think this is where they fell down. But they may not have been in that position to ever had the time to do it, or they may have been misled by the British government into believing that there'd be ample time for that training over there, which there wasn't. Sure.
How do you feel about the Japanese today?
I have no animosity towards the Japanese. My mother did before she died. When I first went back to work after getting out of the army, I worked in a cabinet factory and worked with a young Japanese and on the next saw to him. And my mother just couldn't understand it. But even then, I had no... first of all, you can't blame Japanese people born in Canada for something their forebears didn't in the Far East. But even the Japanese people over there, I never did hold any grudge. Like anything else, I still have a grudge against a couple of Japanese that I'd like to get my hands on. Mm-hmm. But those are personal reasons more than anything else. If it came to another war, Japan was on our side, I wouldn't hesitate to fight beside the Japanese. They're damn good soldiers, and they always will be. They proved that. but no grudges, Ross. As I say, they're just two personal grudges, and I would imagine neither of those two young Japs ever come back to Japan, because if they ended up in the in the South Pacific someplace, chances are they either were shot, killed in action, or committed...
Who are these camp commandants?
No. Kabayasan and Satterthan. Kabayasan was a Japanese foreman we had, he and Sebiasan, and they finally took Kabayasan too. They'd taken Satterthan earlier. But one day, the reason I hold a grudge, he kneed me between the legs and hit me over the head with a wooden practice sword because I had misinterpreted him in his excitement, not mine. We'd unloaded a boxcar load of, it's a caustic of some kind that they use in steel foundry. And the foundry was right across the river, the canal. And this was loaded almost as high as a house in small railway cars, small open gondolas. And it started to rain, and he called for a tarpaulin. And we got the tarp up, and he, in his excitement, he yelled, I still say I did what he told me. I went the wrong way. Anyway, when we were finished, he got down and started to curse me. He called me a son of a bee in Japanese and everything else. And then he kneed me in the knackers and he hit me over the head with this wooden sword. And I dropped. We had a camp commandant at that time that spoke English like an Englishman. And he had told us that if we were mistreated out of work, that he wanted to know about it when we come back in. And when we got in that night, I asked Mac Hawes to get Rance. I wanted to talk to him. And by God, we went to Camp Common, and inside of a month, Kabayasan was gone. I don't know whether that did it or whether his call up had come just at that time. But I told him what had happened. And he said, that's fine. He said, we'll look into it. And that's just the way he was. And I would assume he did. And maybe this is what moved him. But he disappeared. But I would. I'd like to go back and I laugh at him now. But I still have that grudge. And Satterthan was the same way. He hit me over the head with a loading hook. Not the sharp end, but the handle. Because I guess at one time I wasn't too keen on working for them. No. I would only do what I had to do and no more. And he tried to speed me up, told me I was a carol. He swore at me, and then he hit me over the head with a stick. Lovely fun. But they're never do.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you how you feel about war, because you've really been through it. That's sort of, I guess, very philosophical.
Yeah, well, in that sense it is. I would say this.
You've really seen it firsthand.
I'm not a fighter. I'm not a warmonger. But if Canada were threatened again now, I don't think I would, if they could use me, I don't think I'd hesitate to go into the army. I would leave my son's decisions up to them, but I think if my country is good enough for me to earn a living in, that it's damn well good enough for me to fight for. And I wouldn't want to see Canada have to raise an army through volunteers today, but I would fully, if it came to that, I'd fully expect to see my sons do their share. And if I could, I'd do my share. That's the way I feel. But I don't go around preaching war. I feel that at one time the Legion wanted or felt that Canada should have a universal training program. I think it has some merit, but we can't convince the powers that be that they should. I don't think the Army life hurts anybody. whether it be in wartime or peacetime. You're going to, in wartime, you'll get the same as we have today. We had fellas in our outfit from all walks of life that when we come home, we all went back to the walk of life we'd left. If we had just got out of penitentiary, as some of them had, some of them ended up back in penitentiary. Not right away, but it wasn't long after. A lot of them that, a lot of us, in a sense, a lot of them at that time joined the Army because they weren't working, and it was a livelihood. A lot of them have changed their way of living. They've become, we all have for that matter, but some of them that they became, I won't say millionaires, but they bettered themselves. And you have the same thing today. You'll hear people say that they wouldn't want their son to go into the Army because it makes a useless, useless tit of him. He's just as liable to become a useless tit anyway. I mean, no, I look at it this way, and I think it proves it. But I don't think a year or even 2 years for a young fellow, unless he is going to go to university and is capable of achieving something, that even if he's going to university, that 2 years military training would hurt him. It wouldn't. If the training is the right way, I look at the RCMP, the training they get. In a matter of 6 months, they're in top physical condition, and they stay that way. I hate like the devil to see young fellows walking down the street today with their shoulders slouched when there's no need for it, the way some of them walk. That's my personal opinion. No, I don't. I think if a street is worth walking on or life is worth living, hold your head up and walk the way you should walk. And boy, you can sure see some of them slouch along, and I just can't. I can't go for it. My oldest son, I think he looks at things the same way as I do. He was in the reserve, and he's been into served some time in Germany as a reinforcement, not in the active army, but he enjoyed it. And if he had time, he'd still be active in the reserve. The young one here, he's a little too young yet to do anything like that, but I think he'd be the same. That's my feelings in regard to war. I'm not one of these fellows that would say that I wouldn't go again. Because, as I say, I still think Canada is worth fighting for, but I'd like to fight for it someplace else, not here. Because people in Canada just don't know, unless they've come from Europe and they were through that Second World War and come over here as immigrants. Canadian people just don't know what a war can be like until they go through it. I mean it.
The next section is a description of artifacts by Mr. Atkinson, things which he brought back from Hong Kong and Japan, and which is donated to the museum. This is not part of the interview. It's a section which was put in to help catalog the artifacts.
And it give you an idea.
Is it a pretty accurate version of what happened?
It is, but where it's inaccurate is in the names of Dr. Banfield. They call him Bamfil, and Captain Bowman, they call him Bowden. But the rest is reasonably authentic.
Okay.
And
these maps,
those maps are in the book. This one is in the front, in here, and that one is in the back. Now, I wouldn't use these figures here so much, but a combination of these and the ones Colonel Stacy has in his book will give you a breakdown of everything. But there's some reasonably accurate figures in here on Japanese casualties, something that
Colonel Stacy didn't have in his book. And the part I like is where Colonel Soji's regiment, 230th Regiment, moved through Happy Valley and D Company cut them to pieces because they wrote the battalions off. Their plan was for the 230th to go to some other theater of war, and they just didn't go. They didn't have enough men. They cut them to pieces. But there you are there. This is my mess kit. What else we got in here?
You would eat food in this?
Yeah, that held our rice and any green stew vegetables we got. But I engraved that with a nail file, the sharp end of a nail file. Well, it's aluminum, it's easy to cut. But it's all just hand done. But it was something to do. Everybody had something to occupy their time. But this I got in Japan, and I got it while I was in hospital. And a fellow by the name of Reeves had owned it, an American. And when he died, the orderly in the hospital gave it to me. And I have the mess kit, and I can't find it. But if I do, it's got some information on it too. But the kids have used this when they go on camping trips. They use it for a frying pan, and I keep it cleaned up. But there's that. I don't think this is this. This has got tobacco in it, but it's a processed American cheese with bacon. That's the can rations were dropped. They carried a. It's been cut down. Something.
I have a key.
I think we can. What is it? I don't know. I'll tell you what it is.
More of that tobacco. Do you know where that tobacco came from? Did you make it yourselves?
No. Well, that was a Japanese issue. Yeah, it come in a package about 3 inches square and about an inch thick. And it was a lot fresher than it is now. It's gone pretty dry. But the can itself was a American cheese and bacon package can that come in the supplies. These are chopsticks.
Did you have to learn how to eat with chopsticks, or were you eating with your hands?
We had wooden spoons, or some of us were lucky enough to have metal spoons. I didn't bring mine home, but some of them carved wooden spoons. But these, I like eating my rice with chopsticks and anything that was solid in our diet. But these I glommed onto outside of one of the warehouses in Japan. I don't know whether the Nip ever missed them or not, but his name is on the back of them and what he did, and we'd need somebody else to interpret that. I couldn't tell you what that is. That's Japanese characters. There's your car keys. And this I carved in 1944, I guess. It's a little box for carrying tobacco and the two pipes.
Is this part of a uniform and you just sewed it up?
No. I think that's a piece of old blanket that I glommed onto. And the stitching's mine. That's the thread in there is out of a web belt, an army web belt that we had taken apart. But these pipes we also glommed onto. This is braided. It was string and wool string and we just turned it.
No, you'd make this piece?
Yeah, that's made with a small Japanese handsaw, a small Japanese drill. You can see the hole in there, it went in too far. And you drilled out the four corners. You can do that today still. And used a knife to trim out the center. That's all. And this paper is Oh, those are the pipes.
These pipes would be issued to you by the
No, if you had the money, you could get a Jap to buy them. The silver one I bought, I forget what it cost me, a yen or something. But this one I bored one day out of one of the Japs' jackets. The bamboo in there is sort of drying out. There, that's good. But as I mentioned before, you rolled up the tobacco in a small ball and put it in and lit it, and you always had another one handy. When you got three puffs out of it, you dumped the ash in your hand, the coal, put the other ball in, and then just dump the hot coal over on the tobacco and away you went again.
So you get a couple of bowls and you just keep that up?
Oh yeah, yeah. Just well, as long as you had a break for smoke, you kept changing balls. Not everybody smoked them. A lot of them rolled that tobacco into cigarettes with that toilet paper as I showed you here. But a lot of us had developed a little sort of callus on your hand just from the coal, the hot tobacco. This is tobacco here, too, wrapped up. This is part, I don't know what part of the plane it was. There's two pieces there. Here's part of an anti-aircraft shell that landed on the docks. And this is a piece of the plane that they hit, an American plane off one of the carriers. That landed on. Well, it's the only thing we could figure out. There was a fair hunk of it. That's the piece I got. Some of the others got another piece. But that also is engraved with a nail file.
And from a Jap Zero fighter in the back?
No. Who put that on there? Take that off. That's not Jap Zero. That's an American.
That's not from America?
Yeah, sure. They hit one. The dive bombed the docks.
This would be from...
That's the Japanese anti-aircraft shell. They had, in late 1945, before we were liberated, they had, I mentioned that on there, they brought in all their anti-aircraft guns. But their ships in the harbor, they were just like a mortar bomb. The men just stood there and dropped these things down, and I don't know whether they must have worked on a spring of some kind, but it was like a pom-pom. And they did this in the harbor, but this was an anti-aircraft shell. We don't know whether it hit the plane or what, but this is the piece that landed on the dock. And this was a piece off the American plane itself that they hit. And this, used to be about 2 feet by 5 feet long when it hit the dock. And I got a small piece of it. But I think one of the kids did that and misinterpreted what I told them because this stuff has gone to school umpteen times to show and tell.
Did you make a bracelet out of it?
Yeah, that's, I don't know where I got the leather from, but may have been the tongue off one of my boots. And this, that's hard to say where I got this from. But we stole it someplace. Now, this is a Maritsu hat badge, Maritsu, M-A-R, oh, here it is here, the dockyard, M-A-R, Maritsu, M-A-R-U-T-S-O, Maritsu, dockyard workers hat badge that I stole, belonged on it. What else have they got in here? Toilet tissue used mostly for cigarettes, you've got that on there now. This is Japanese currency. It's not their military currency. This is money that 50 cent notes, 50 cent and yen notes, and they also had silver. But we were paid 10 cent a day for working. And as I mentioned earlier, when we did have a yasume day, a rest day, once a month, or twice a month, or on our number day, as we call it, if there was any of the fellas in camp that liked to play cards or play dice, there was always some accommodating fellas around that would play. And this would change hands back and forth, and I brought these two. I had more than that at one time, but where it's gone, I don't know. We had
I had accumulated 1,000 yen at one time. My Len Mulvaney was the big winner all the time. That's all that box.
How much toilet paper would you get reissued a month?
Oh, this is an accumulation. I don't know. It's hard to say. But there must be about 20 sheets here. Well, we used it for cigarettes. To make cigarettes with. In going to the tan, when you have dysentery or a soft stool, there wasn't too much to worry about.
Yeah.
And some of us, we had a tap in there. It was much easier to use a cloth. We found that the Indians, the Indian troops, never, they used bottled water, and they just rinsed themselves off.
Mm.
And partly maybe that was the reason, but we would, it was just as easy using the cloth and using the toilet paper for something else. Well, that won't go in there.
No.
Now that's a book that we stole. It's not all there, the top cover's gone. But out of the Army warehouse, it's a blank, it's a sort of a record book. And that's my picture there. They were taken in Japan in 1943 in October. And I weighed 110 pounds when the picture was taken. My number is 157, and I've written over it because you couldn't, the seven's there, but you couldn't see the one and five in front. We looked like a real jailbird there. And this is Ray Sosan's picture here. He is from, originally he was from this place here, New Brunswick, no, the Gaspé Peninsula. Where is it? He wrote this in here. Shigewak, County Bonaventure, Province of Quebec, Canada. Mm-hmm. Ray is in Montreal now and I've lost track of him. I haven't heard from him for about, 12 years anyway. He lost two brothers over there. But his number was 151 and mine was 157, and the fellas between us were all dead. They all died. Time went on. But in here, there's both Canadian and American, English, Englishmen's names and everything else. Hank Barra was a Spanish fellow from New Mexico, San Antonio here. But they all had something to say. An old American coolie, as he depicts here in his picture. This was, as I said, Andy Custer, the Dutch fellow off the Dutch submarine. Johnny Blay was another Spanish fellow. He was from New Mexico. Garlino Lovato, he was the regimental sergeant major of the Americans. Hank Lovato. He was also from New Mexico. But they were taken prisoner. They were in the American Air Force. Tommy Forsyth, Grenadier, he's still in Pipestone. Garley, he was another American. Freddie Wall, I think Freddie's dead now. He was the Royal Winnipeg, Royal Rifle of Canada. There's Henry Dyer, the pharmacist mate that looked after my boils on the LSV in Tokyo Bay. Jerry Mabley, he's still here. Howard Naylor, he's in Victoria, but I lost track of him. Mulvaney, one of the best gamblers the Winnipeg Grenadiers ever had, Len and his brother Tom. POW 88, double eights. Ernie Neal is a guard at the jail in Fort Frances still. He comes in every year to our reunion. Fiddler, Ray Fiddler, he was injured with me in that building that collapsed. He's at Deer Lodge Hospital, works there. Nick Ostmeyer, another Dutchman. Charlie Dillon, he was in the Marine Corps. An American. Great big, he must have been about 6'4". And again, that's Ray Sosan's note. And this is Rance, our interpreter. Ransel, as we call him. Lost track of him too, Ross. I don't know whether he went back to Hong Kong or what. An Americans, Harold Beaver, the Marine Corps. Jack Parker, he was the one I mentioned that Camp Covenant put the boots to. He was a civilian. Ah, here's the one here. For now, just a line, but afterwards a cup for auld lang syne, Paddy O'Hara. Glasgow, Scotland. A name like O'Hara from Scotland. There's another one in here. Yeah, this is the one, Paddy Whelan. The bird of time has but little way to flutter, and lo, the bird is on the wing. He wrote that about the 4th or 5th of August. As I say, we knew close then that it would get near the end. Ozzie Roberts, I don't know whether he's still alive or not. He was from the Rifles. Fray Briard, he came back with us. He was one of the 10 that first back. He was a shoemaker, did everything. Dan Six, he was a civilian from Wake Island. And who was the other one? No, that's just... Oh, Thomas. Jerry Kenny was another one. John Turner. No, there's a few more there. There's not that many there. Bob Manchester, he's at the coast. He was one of our sergeants. The rifle. Bill Maltman, you met Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Noisy Bill. Smokey Middleton. Oh, there, I got to tell you that story. Remember I told you about Cyclone Pete, Pistol Pete?
Mm-hmm.
Smokey was an American, and we were liberated. We're down at the station, waiting to get on the train. Pistol Pete, Cyclone Pete, come along, shaking hands with everybody. And he stopped in front of Smokey because the Japanese, they had bayonet fighting equipment. They used wooden rifles, and they were always trying to coax us into something. And Smokey went out one day and just about knocked the heads off one of them. And Cyclone Pete come along, Pistol Pete come along to say goodbye. And Smokey just hauled off and whacked him one of the chops. He just couldn't stand them. And he just had to let it go. That was it. These, now, you said something about having or seeing one of these before.
Yes, I have a copy.
You have a copy of it. Yes. Now, how about that one?
Yes, sir.
You have a copy of that, too? Harry McNaughton?
Yes.
Shadow Lights of Shamshapo?
Yes.
All right, I'll keep those here. There. You can make a picture of those maps.
I should maybe take the Shadow Lights of Shamshapo.
All right.
Just to make sure that...
All right. All right. Good. And this stuff, the mess kit, as long as you mark where you got it from, you can keep it down there. I don't care.
Right.
I just assume.
Because
it'll go, if anything ever happens to me, it just could go astray. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether this is worth anything or not.
Oh, I think so.
But I'll tell you, these pictures. Dick Wilson, out at Bossier,
mm-hmm.
must have 300 of pictures, period.
Fine.
It would be very interesting if they were set up. And I think as long as he knew where they were going and what they were for, I'll tell you, you may find Dick a little... tell you what, before you go see him, phone Art Lozier, or get Stanton, phone Art Lozier. Dick is...